rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn.
Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting February 23rd.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History on February 23rd in 1971, Lieutenant William Calley confesses he directed the Max execution of South Vietnamese civilians at My Lai and implicates his commanding officer, Captain Ernest Medina, who he says issued the orders to murder. Both are dandies of the right-wingers who support their illegal activities. By the way, the initial investigating officer of the My Lai massacre who started the cover-up was then First Lieutenant Colin Powell of the Bush administration fame. Also more news on February 23rd for 1981. The White Papers on El Salvador issued by the State Department defending U.S. intervention and secret intervention and support of right-wing militia takeover of the government. One of the many atrocities the U.S. supported was death squads. The most infamous of them was the assassination of Catholic Bishop Oscar Romero, who was shot during a mass, a month after publicly asking U.S. government to stop military aid to El Salvadorian government. Also at his funeral, the government military bombers and snipers massacred 42 mourners.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so.
More illegal American interest in 1989. Lieutenant Colonel Ollie North is on trial for illegally selling weapons to Iran so that unlimited funds would still be available for the CIA's illegal and undeclared war against Nicaragua. Today, Federal Prosecutor Walsh agrees to drop the conspiracy charges against North. Though eventually found guilty of the cover-up, President Bush Sr. would give Ollie a Christmas pardon. Merry Christmas, Ollie North. Thanks for violating the Constitution for us.
We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
This Week in Radical History for February 24th, 1899, more of the same in Nicaragua. U.S. Marines begin fighting in the Blue Fields and mine its harbor, all to protect American interests. Also on February 24th, 1912, labor activist Elizabeth Flynn heads the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike of 20,000 women. Later today, police would attack 150 children and their parents at the town railroad station to suppress the strike. Also on February 24th, 1968, Pete Seeger, blacklisted for years on network television, is finally allowed to sing his previously censored Waist Deep in the Big Muddy on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. The Smothers Brothers show itself would eventually get axed, despite its high ratings, as corporate sponsors threaten to cancel network contracts because of the controversial acts the Smothers Brothers allow on their show.
Well, I'm not going to plant any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
This Week in Radical History for February 25th, 1860, about 100 Wyatt Indian men, women, and children were massacred during the World Renewal Ceremony. The massacre was carried out by white immigrants who had just settled in the area since 1850 as part of the California Gold Rush. The massacre was particularly grisly because the men who paddled to the island used hatchets, axes, and clubs to murder the victims. They purposefully avoided using their guns so that local residents in nearby town would not hear the slaughter. A little bit of Wisconsin news on February 25, 1902. The mill manager of Whiting Paper Company in Plover, Wisconsin, discharges a shipping clerk who is trying to organize workers in the plant. His outraged co-workers held a protest rally and demanded the company to reinstate the clerk. When nothing happened, 25 union men shut down the plant and walked out, followed by about 20 women employed in the finishing room. By April, strikes disrupted plants up and down the Wisconsin River Valley. The American Federation of Labor and the Wisconsin State Federation of Labor sent support, but companies stood firm and by the end of April defeated the strikers. Well, lately the Washington Post has been in the news, and also in 1908 on this date, the Washington Post proposes that all anarchists be put to death, whether culpable or not, of any crime or offense. Also on February 25, 1913, the Patterson Silk Strike begins, involving over 20,000 workers. It would last for 6 months. Also on February 25, 1918, newspaper report that government charged Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman for working as German spies in foreign countries. Those charges, of course, will be later dismissed. 1 year later, Go Ahead, a circular attributed to American anarchists, appears throughout New England. In it, American anarchists threaten to dynamite officials in retaliation for the ongoing deportation and repression of anarchists are enduring. When pushed, often people push back. In related news on this date in 1920, anarchists Roberto Alia and Andrea Salzdito are taken into custody by the Department of Justice without warrant or being arrested. They are held and beaten for 8 weeks and not allowed to contact family, friends, or lawyers, in an effort to get them informed on fellow anarchists. Attorney General Palmer's raid of terror was going full stream against immigrant radicals. To Palmer and his zealous band of immigrant pursuers, they were on a mission to rid the country of Red Satans, or anarchists who seemed bent on dismantling America's free enterprise system. A couple more items for February 25, 1964. 172,000 students boycott Chicago schools to protest segregation. Also on that date in 1970, Vista Vista, California, Bank of America burns, and riots break out to protest the Chicago 7 guilty verdicts, which ends with a lot of Bank of America buildings in flames. Part of a nationwide upheaval against the verdicts came down on the 19th, with 500,000 people in the streets, and explosions in 3 office buildings in New York, as well as more attacks in California, Washington, Maryland, and Michigan. Also on that date in 1993 in India, 60,000 preemptively arrested to prevent a demonstration against the ruling government. Last on this date in 1994, Israel, Jewish settler opens fire, kills 29 Palestinians praying in the mosque in Hebron. Oddly, Israeli government does not rush in and declare martial law and bulldoze Jewish homes in response. Barak Goldman, an American Orthodox Israel doctor who murdered 29 Arabs with automatic weapons, was proclaimed by some Jews to be a Kadash, meaning holy. This week in radical history for February 26, 1932, the man in black, Johnny Cash, is born. Jamie Lee Jackson on this date, February 26, 1965, was a young, unarmed civil rights protester who was shot by an Alabama state trooper. Jackson's death was among the many abuses of African Americans had to endure, and the Selma and Montgomery marches would spring up around them as important events in the American civil rights movement. Also on this date in 1974, Henry Ford, an anti-Semite, Nazi sympathizer, was revealed in a Senate report that Ford made tons of money on both sides of Axis and Allies of the war. It's the American way, after all, free market economics, etc. His profits from the Nazis still circulate in U.S. government politics to this day. Yeah, let's bail them all out. Have you driven your Ford lately?
This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 26, in 1976, the dead body of Anna Mae Pictou-Aquash was found. Anna Mae was a prominent member of the American Indian Movement. It is generally believed that she was executed by other AIM members who were convinced that she was an informant for the FBI. One thing is certain, the murder of Anna Mae Aquash was a direct result of the tactics used by the FBI's counterintelligence program, which regularly used disinformation and lies to plant suspicions and divide the American Indian Movement. Using these tactics, the FBI wiped out many amazing revolutionaries through murder and imprisonment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. On this day, February 27th in 1880, writer and poet Angelina Weld Grimke was born to a white mother and a black father. Due to racial tensions, Grimke's mother left the family, and from the time that Angelina was 7 years old, she was raised by her father and his family in Boston. Throughout her life, Angelina Grimke published many literary pieces, from poetry to short stories. A lot of Grimke's work was based on her experience as a biracial woman in America, and also on the isolation she felt as a lesbian woman in the late 1800s. On this day, February 28th in 1525, the last Aztec emperor, Cuauhtémoc, was assassinated. When Cuauhtémoc came to power 5 years earlier, the Spanish had already begun their conquest of the Americas. The Aztec Empire fought the Spanish off for as long as they could, but in 1521, Emperor Cuauhtémoc was forced to surrender to Hernán Cortés. 4 years later, Cortés took Cuauhtémoc to Honduras, where he ordered him to be hung. Spanish colonization of the Americas continued, and the indigenous people, once conquered, were often exploited and murdered. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on February 28, 1861, six of 44 chiefs in the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho sign a treaty with Fort Wise, agreeing to cede their lands and live on a small reservation in southwest Colorado. The U.S. Commissioner of Indian Affairs issues medals, blankets, sugars, and tobacco. Ah, six of the 44 chiefs, good enough. Also on this date in 1977, more Native American news as the American government seized the Black Hills from the Lakota Sioux in violation of a treaty they signed years earlier. Now, what a surprise.
Badges. We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
A couple more items. 1933 in Germany. Following yesterday's burning of the Berlin Reichstag, torched by the Nazis, the propaganda arm blames the anarchists and unionists to rally their people. You say Reichstag, I say Pearl Harbor, I say WMD, you say 9/11, I say JFK, you say... Lastly, in a state in 1986, though the comments were on tape, acting President Reagan denies he called the reporter sons of a bitches. The presidential mouthpiece, Larry Speaks, claimed Reagan said, "It's sunny, and you're rich." This week in Radical History for March 1st, the last one for this week, 1790, the first census count that includes slaves and free blacks. Native Americans, don't include them. Also March 1st, 1875, Congress gives African Americans the right to serve on juries in the wake of the Civil War. Black men were briefly able to vote and hold elected offices until Jim Crow laws came into play about a year later. Also on March 1st, 1906, Emma Goldman publishes the first anarchist paper called Mother Earth. Also on this date in 1921 in Russia, 15,000 mutiny at Kronstadt against Marxist tyranny. From March 1st to March 17th, the old Bolshevik stronghold of Kronstadt rises, demanding free elections to adopt a 15-point program of political and economic demands, a program in open defiance of the Bolshevik Party control of the Soviet state. Almost immediately, the Bolsheviks denounced the uprising as a White Guard plot of counter-revolutionary conspirators. Less than 3 weeks later, on March 17, Kronstadt was subdued by a bloody assault by the select Red Army units. The Kronstadt uprising, to all appearances, had little more to do with passing an episode of bitter history of civil war. We can now say, however, that the Kronstadt uprising marked the end of the Russian Revolution itself. Lastly, on this date in 1971, the Weathermen Underground bombs U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. in retaliation for the decision for America to invade Laos. Here's part of the Weathermen Underground Communique No. 5.
We did not choose to live in a time of war. We chose only to become guerrillas and to urge our people to prepare for war rather than become accomplices in the genocide of our sisters and brothers. We learned from American history about policies of extermination of an entire people and their magnificent cultures, the Indians, the blacks, the Vietnamese. We are making plans to resist with all of our creativity. Students and hippies who now hear peace talk from the white man must remember how talk of peace was used against the Indians and preached to the blacks. Today, many student leaders have cut their hair and called for peace. They say young people shouldn't provoke the government, and they receive in return promises of peaceful change. Promises of peace from a government that bombs Cambodia while talking about an end to war, that killed students at Jackson and Kent while calling for responsibility on campus, that murdered Fred Hampton and hundreds of blacks while calling for racial harmony. Remember that American pigs have already dropped more bombs on a piece of land about the size of Florida than the entire tonnage dropped during World War II. Don't be tricked by talk. Arm yourselves and shoot to live. We are building a culture and a society that can resist genocide. It is a culture of total resistance to mind-controlling maniacs, a culture of high-energy sisters getting it on, of hippie acid smiles and communes and freedom to be the farthest out people we can be.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die.
Since this week is the birthday of the man in black, Johnny Cash, we're ending this week with his nod toward the electric chair, the Mercy Seat song. This Week in Radical History is produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. We've used some audio from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI for this week's show, and we thank them for their awesome work. Now back to this awesome song. However, never forget and always remember, I'm forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, the ark of his testament is stowed, a throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire, and God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb, my head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
تمتطي فوزا قزح طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. On This Week in Palestine, we have been following the attempts of the Zionist propaganda machine to silence Palestinian voices on campuses throughout the country, such as Students for Justice in Palestine and the BDS movement. We often hear how Jewish students complain that their voices, movements, and organizations create an unsafe environment for them, and that pro-Palestinian political activity is anti-Semitic. Such allegations were made by Jewish students during the hearing on the anti-BDS bill at the Massachusetts State House on July 18th concerning Tufts University. However, Tufts professor Tom Abood, following his testimony before the Joint Committee on State Administration and Regulatory Oversight, was questioned about this alleged activity at Tufts by a member of the committee. Professor Abood's response was that just the opposite was true. It was Zionist students who were on the offense at Tufts, and individual examples of harassment of Jewish students could not be cited. The fallback position of the Zionist students was that political activity opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine was anti-Semitic and created an unsafe climate on campus for Jewish students, period. That seems to be the talking point on several campuses across the country as Israel tries to amp up opposition to the successful and growing Palestinian-led BDS campaign. One of the campuses where pushback against pro-Palestinian activity is most virulent is San Francisco State University. There, a courageous and outspoken Palestinian professor, Rabab Abdulhadi, is under attack by the Zionist factions on campus. This morning, she tells her story. This presentation was recorded live by This Week in Palestine at the Truro Public Library. Here is the introduction of and presentation by Professor Rabab Abdulhadi of San Francisco State University.
Professor Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi is a senior scholar of Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diaspora studies program at the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University. This is a historic state university which had the first and longest strike in 1968, which is the basis for ethnic studies across the United States. It was the first ethnic studies program and college, and the only college in the U.S., and it is the basis that we have ethnic studies, which, of course, is being challenged in many states as we speak. Dr. Abdulhadi is a longtime Palestinian community leader, an academic. She has been targeted by right-wing groups and now recently has been named in a lawsuit filed against San Francisco State University by the Lawfare Project, and she'll speak to that, Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming, and thank the Truro Public Library for actually having what really needs to happen in all the libraries. Discussion, critical discussion, dialogue, understanding what's going on and making decisions based on that. I also want to thank Stuart Ewing, professor at Hunter College, who actually helped in designing the flyer, and I also want to thank my professor and mentor and comrade in arms, Professor Raz Pichowski. Before I begin, I would like to acknowledge that we are meeting on indigenous soil and indigenous people's land. And that's really important to acknowledge where we are and understand the privilege that we have. I'm not going to take a lot of time because we would like to get to the question and answer discussion. But I wanted to speak to the title of the panel, Is Questioning Israel Anti-Semitic? And I'm speaking based on my experience as a Palestinian who grew up under Israeli occupation, as a Palestinian who went back and forth on family visits, starting 1992 from here to the U.S., until the last visit was in March and April 2000, last year, as a scholar of Palestine, actually this is my work, my expertise, and as a committed activist for advocacy for justice in Palestine as part of the indivisibility of justice, justice for all. Why is this attack? Why is it that there is this attack using anti-Semitism against advocates for justice in Palestine? This is where I would like to start. And I'm going to share some of the stuff about what's going on with us at San Francisco State. I'm more than happy to discuss it in the Q&A. But I want to talk about the bigger picture. And then I can come back, and if you would like, we can talk about it. The first question is, why not? Why not question Israel? Why is Israel an exceptional to any other country? Israel is a state that receives $38 billion from USAID, that in the United States, people have the right to question a country that has such a strategic relationship with the U.S. Israel is a state that members of the international community, including people in the United States, have the right to ask questions about. Israel claims to have a higher moral ground than any other country. Don't need to talk about the higher moral grounds. You can just talk about it as a state. Violates international law, day in and day out, every single day. But what's happening is that the right-wing pro-Israeli industry, and I call it an industry, and I'll talk why is that in a minute, they want to speak for Jews, all Jews, across time, across place, in every single context, and say that they are also the only and authentic voice of Jews. And we know that's simply not true. There hasn't been a unified Jewish experience ever. And actually saying that there is one Jewish experience is in itself contributes to anti-Semitism. It stereotypes Jews to only being one thing only. And that's actually highly problematic throughout the history. I teach a course on Palestine. And I spend the first 3 weeks talking about the history of anti-Semitism, the history of Zionism, how Jews ended up in Palestine, what happened with the Israeli state, and so on and so forth. We don't have time to go through it all. But I begin by showing the students that there are multiple experiences. Historically, there has been a discussion of what to do, quote-unquote, with the Jewish problem, which Marx talks about the Jewish question. Namely, the anti-Semitism, the pogroms, the discrimination against Jews, specifically in Eastern Europe. It is a European issue. It wasn't in Arab countries. It wasn't in Muslim rule. It was in Europe, in Eastern Europe in particular, and also in Western Europe, as we know from the Dreyfus Affair and Herzl's. And I think all of you know what I'm talking about, so I'm not going to go into details into that, just reminding us of these things. Marx came with one solution. The Bund, the group in the Russian Revolution, came with a similar solution. And there were also the Zionists who came up with a different solution, led by Herzl in the various Zionist conferences. I'm not going to go into all of this. But there was the discussion by Herzl specifically of the Jewish state in his book, The Jewish State. And it's not the Jewish state. It's not Israel. It's a Jewish state with a small s, in which he argued that what needs to happen is that all the Jews need to gather in one place because anti-Semitism is inherent to every single society. Obviously, a lot of us disagree with that. We do not believe that is the case. We believe that every racism and discrimination, any society, we need to confront and fight against it, and we cannot be silent. Because if we are silent, it continues. And it would lead like something like the Holocaust in the Second World War. You can be silent. You need to confront it. You need to face it head on. But is the solution to have a separate space for every single group that has discriminated against it? Or is the solution to think about actually confronting all sorts of injustices together and change society altogether? And I advocate for the second problem. That's one aspect of it. Historically, again, if you go through all Jewish history and all human history, always there has never been a consensus. Even in the United States, worldwide, by the way, even in the United States, the only time we started seeing a dominant view of Jewishness equals support for Israel and Zionism was after the 1967 war, 50 years ago. But that did not mean that majority of the Jews necessarily agreed with that viewpoint. The voices were dumped, the voices were dimmed, they were not being heard and so on. And we see the rise of a particular viewpoint that says that This is the viewpoint that Jewishness means Israel, Jewishness means Zionism, and that's not necessarily shared by a lot of people. Now, this becomes actually more of a problem, anti-Semitism, because we have people in the White House who are actually real anti-Semites. We have neo-Nazis, we have the Breitbart, we have Bannon, we have all of these people, which is very interesting because at the same time that they are anti-Semitic, they're very supportive of Israel. So now we actually see differences between the two. They're actually not one and the same. And it's something to keep in mind. But what do these groups, the right-wing groups, that actually also have their alliances in the White House, because as you know, at Trump's inauguration, Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul who funds and finances a lot of these right-wing groups, was sitting right there next to Trump in the White House inauguration. And he and the Koch brothers and the Bradley Foundation, Koret Foundations, are actually big funders of these groups. Actually, in 2014, Adelson convened a meeting at his casino in Las Vegas, which was leaked out, of specifically pro-Israeli groups who wanted to silence anything that happens on campuses. I mean, that was the reason of the meeting, and the Israeli government committed, I guess, $26 million, and so on. What do they do? They confuse Israel, Zionism, Jewishness in order to muddy the waters. As Palestinians, actually historically and contemporarily, we have always argued that there is a distinction. There is a distinction between Israel and Zionism and between Jewishness. And historically there has been distinction too. And the distinction is not only between secular, quote-unquote secular or Marxist Jews, religious Jews too, there isn't a unified verdict about what works. And you can see there is a lot of interpretation. Some people say, well, the Zionists basically took advantage of the religion, the Torah and the Old Testament and so on, in order to convince more Jews to participate. They were all socialist atheists and so on. And they basically started saying, let's use the Torah before, in order to support the establishment of Israel. First the immigration to Palestine and then the establishment of Israel. And because the Western countries closed their doors to Jewish refugees who were escaping from the Holocaust, and there was nowhere else to go to for them except to go to Palestine. That was the only place for them to go. That's where people ended up. But Palestinians, and I want to like say this again and again, and I used to say it in the past, but I'm mistaken. I'm correcting myself. Palestinians are not the victims of the victims. We have not been victimized by the survivors of the Holocaust. We have been victimized by the founders of Zionism. We have been victimized by the Zionists from Eastern Europe who actually came and set up the project of settling in Palestine. It wasn't the Holocaust survivors. The Holocaust survivors had nowhere else to go. That's the only place they could go. And you know the history of the United States and Western Europe and so on. I don't need to repeat it to you. Okay. So, and historically, as Palestinians, we stood very clearly against Zionism and Israel, and we stood very clearly about the project of actually being part of a different vision for the future of Palestine, in which all people who are living in that space work together. It's not even just one person, one vote, like the South African project at one point. It's actually much more engaged and much more, and including actually Jews who came after 1948 and settled in Palestine. Again and again and again, Palestinians repeat that. The problem is that not known? That's not known. That is not known. Why is that not known? Because these right-wing groups need to muddy the waters. If they create enough noise, people will start believing in it. It doesn't matter what the truth is. It just matters that you create enough noise, and then exactly like the charges against me and the accusations that have been founded untrue several times over, it doesn't matter because you create enough noise, and then people start believing that this is the truth, and they say, well, there is no smoke without fire. There must be a fire out there. Even if people believe you and they're saying you're guilty until proven innocent. This is how the power of discourse. You create a noise, enough noise, that people start believing in it. And we know now we're in the age of Trump. We know how that works out, right? Now they're discussing the health care, the Obamacare, and now they don't even know what to do about it, right? So what's going on today is a very cynical use of anti-Semitism, really misuse of anti-Semitism, which actually also is very serious and dangerous because it makes it it makes it harder and more dangerous to be able to find anti-Semitism, the real anti-Semitism. Because when they mix up everything together, it becomes much harder than that. And also, they claim to speak in the name of all Jews. What do they do? If you want to talk, I can tell you about the lawsuit. I read the whole thing. They cite each other. It doesn't matter, again, if it's true or not. One of the main sources is the Anti-Defamation League. Anti-Defamation League is one of the most discredited sources. Some people think that actually spies defamation. No. The history of Anti-Defamation League, it spied on 647 organizations, including Foreign Labor Organizing Committee, Black Panther Party, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, NAACP, at least 58 Arab American organizations, thousands of Arab Americans. One of the main agents of Anti-Defamation League in the San Francisco, they actually, the FBI one time went and raided and they found everything. They found the key to the office of Alex Ode, the West Coast Regional Director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who was killed by a pipe bomb in his office. His killers are now living in an Israeli settlement and Israel is refusing to extradite him, Israeli colony. They cite Alga Minor. Alga Minor is a front page of David Horowitz that is produced by Campus Watch. People know what Campus Watch is. Daniel Pipes. Daniel Pipes is one of the, actually named, him and Horowitz are two of the leading Islamophobes by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Southern Poverty Law Center, do people know? Southern Poverty Law Center is the one that fought against the KKK and basically drove them out of business. And they are considered to be two of the leading Islamophobes, anti-black, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim organizers. They basically in the business of producing what real fake news, fake news the way Trump talks about it. They have a group called Amcha that has been specializing in attacking us, in particular at San Francisco State. They have submitted several claims and complaints to Department of Justice, Department of Education. Every single claim they came was turned incorrect, inaccurate. There was no basis for it. In September 2016, three reports were published about San Francisco State University, University of California, Irvine, and CUNY, City University of New York, in which the Zionist Organization of America here at CUNY, at San Francisco State, there was the Hillel Student Fund Organization. And at UC Irvine, there were also Zionist groups, including Jewish Community Relations Council. And they said that there is a climate on campus that makes Jewish students afraid, and it's hostile to Jewish students. Thus, there is inherent anti-Semitism on campuses. Each of these reports said that actually Palestinian advocacy for justice in Palestine, had nothing to do with Jewish students, that this was against Israel, questioning Israel again, and against the actions of that has to do with Israel. It's advocacy for justice in Palestine. And as a matter of fact, to add, that half of the students in Students for Justice in Palestine are Jewish. But that doesn't work for these right-wing groups because they do not like to acknowledge that they are not the first and the last authority on what Jewishness is or anti-Semitism. And increasingly, there are more... I'm doing okay with time, right? Yeah, okay. I got thrown off. We're waiting for a report from San Francisco State today about part of the case, so I got distracted looking at the time. Who are these organizations? I'm going to name them and I'm not going to, I can actually discuss them in details because I know them really well. Amcha, which is two people based in, one is University of California, Santa Cruz, and one in Los Angeles. Stand With Us, Zionist Organization of America, Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is actually building a museum of tolerance on the ruins of the Palestinian cemetery in Jerusalem called Mamilla. David Horowitz, Freedom Center. By the way, David Horowitz attacks Movement for Black Lives, the sanctuary movement on campuses, with the same zealousness that he attacks us. So we're in good company. Campus Watch, Daniel Pipes, who is in the business of producing propaganda, his Middle East Forum is the same group. The David Project, Brandeis Center and the Lawfare. The Lawfare Project is the one that actually now has waged the lawsuit. And the director of the Lawfare Project, just to start from the last piece, actually said that we are going to make the enemy pay. Our goal is to make the enemy pay. The enemy are activists on campuses, students, faculty, staff, who are advocating for justice in Palestine as part of Justice for All, including people like me and other people. And in 2015, a group called International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network actually did a report called the Backlash Report, in which scholars and activists studied IRS return forms, 501c3 organizations of all these organizations, and they come out with the conclusion, that's where they revealed that the funding comes from Adelson, Sheldon Adelson, from the Koch brothers, from Bradley, from Coret. It's right-wing. It's all these funders, right-wing, racist, anti-women, anti-labor, anti-environment. And they are attacking all of us on this basis. Why is this attack intensifying? Let me just give a little bit of history. 2008-2009, Israel attacked Gaza. That began to seem to people that it's a very, very disproportional attack and so on. A lot of people rose and said, this is not okay. Ships started going to Gaza to take medical supplies and food to try to break the blockade. Same way as people from the United States tried to break the blockade of Cuba. And now it looks like people are back again in the same, right, struggle. And in 2010, a ship from Turkey by the name of Mavi Marmara went to try to cross international waters, and Israel killed people on that ship. More people around the world started getting more upset, and more people in the United States started joining the rest of humanity in saying this is not okay. In 2010, an institute in Israel called the Reut Institute, R-E-U-T, published a report saying that we really need to deal with something called the delegitimization network. The delegitimization network is the network, basically, according to them, is the network of people who are advocating for justice in Palestine on different university campuses and elsewhere, adopting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions strategy, saying that Israel needs to be abiding by international law, and until it does, you need to boycott it, you need to boycott this institution, you need to not divest from it, and you need to impose sanctions on it. Going by the same strategy that the civil rights movement in the United States pursued, going by the same strategy that the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa pursued, many, by the way, there's a lot of examples. This is not the only two. And actually, Catherine Franke, if you are in Boston, read the Boston Globe, wrote a very, very good article. She's a professor of law at Columbia University about the boycotts. This past week, talking about the whole anti-BDS. So the more attacks on it, the more. So what they started doing, the more expansion of the support for Palestine, legitimacy for Palestine, the more people in the U.S. join the rest of humanity, the more escalating the attack happens. And if you look at all the statistics are showing that more and more people are more sympathetic to Palestinian rights in the U.S. I mean, this is including younger Jewish kids on campuses that are saying, Israel doesn't speak in my name. You cannot be going and killing Palestinians. You cannot be setting a young youth on fire, making him drink petrol and setting him, burning him alive. You can do all this. Please do not speak in my name. You know, you shouldn't be doing it. But if you're doing it, you're not doing it in my name. Don't say that you're now doing it in the name of the Jewish people. That's not right. You're not. And the more that happens, the more support there is, the more Israel and its supporters get upset. Because Israel and its current government, for many governments now, are not interested in changing the status quo. They are interested in annexing what is remains of what Raz talked about, the Area C that is remaining. They are interested in choking Gaza. There is no electricity in Gaza today, and people are actually, some kids are dying as a result of not being to get out or not having electricity and access and hospitals and medication or water. Okay, so all of this stuff is going on, More and more people are saying, I can't associate with Israel. I cannot associate with these actions. Please do not speak in my name. You do not speak in my name. And for that, they need to be punished. In 2014, I'm skipping another war on Gaza. This has gotten worse because we know that over 2,000 Palestinians were killed. Everybody saw on TV the attack on the beach of killing the kids who were playing on the beach. Everybody heard about what happened to Muhammad Abu Khdir in Jerusalem, who was burned and set alive. People later on heard about the Babshe, the kid who was with his family burned by settlers. And at the same time in this country also, there were protests in Ferguson after the killing of Michael Brown by the police. And it exposed the relationship between law enforcement agencies in the United States and Israeli military and police, that they are both collaborating. And I just want to make sure that people don't misunderstand. So if the collaboration ends, it doesn't mean that everything in the United States is going to be fine and dandy. I.e., U.S. law enforcement agents are not just contaminated by Israel. They are rotten in themselves, and they actually need to be upheld to standards and transparency and accountability and so on. So just so people say, oh, if we just, everything will be okay. No, it's not going to be okay. We have a lot of work ahead of us. And in that summer, more people, Ferguson was occupied exactly like the occupations of the... occupied like the Palestinian areas are occupied, and we saw more and more support. The University of California graduate students who are unified in a union called UAW Local 2865 has 13,000 to 14,000 members voted to boycott before BDS, American Studies Association, Native American Indigenous Studies Association, Association of Asian American Studies, the National Association of Chicano Studies. Okay, JVP is already, Jewish Voice for Peace is already on board. I mean, more and more people are saying this is not okay. What Israel is doing is not okay. We need to hold Israel accountable. And what they were doing is they actually making distinction and separating Israel as a state from the concept of Jewish people. That was really, really important, because for a very long time they muddied the water and they mixed up things. Some artists like Beyoncé don't go. They say, oh, well, there's other reasons or whatever. But this is a pressure campaign. They don't want to be seen as attaching their names. It's exactly very similar. I was very active in the anti-apartheid movement, and it is very similar to what happened then. It took a while at the beginning. And a lot of people were naysayers, were questioning. Reagan had a policy of talking about constructive engagement. Constructive engagement. Let's engage the apartheid regime and see if we can convince them. And it's like, okay, this is hundreds of years, and now you're still talking about constructive engagement. And people said, no, we need to boycott Citibank. We need to do this and this and this and this. And more people joined. There is always a few people at the beginning. And then other people who are a little skeptical, don't know what's going on. Some people are concerned about anti-Semitism and so on. They realize that this is not the case. They realize that more and more, and actually a lot of people who are advocating for justice in Palestine are Jewish themselves, but it's not just Jewish. It's people of all walks of life who do not like to see injustices taking place. I mean, this is really the bottom line. What they try to do, and I want to talk about the specific of the tactics, that they begin by maligning people and smearing campaigns. If that doesn't work, they will go and pressure administrators, as what happened with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, firing Stephen Salaita, and we now know from public record requests that actually the chancellor of the university and the chair of the board of trustees of the university actually were very much in bed with businesses that had businesses with Israel. So it wasn't kind of like ideological or somebody voting their conscience or something. There is also material interests that were involved. If that doesn't work, they would try other procedural things. So, for example, this year we saw that California State University at Fresno canceled the search for the Edward Said position of studies under some procedural rules, and now they're delaying it till next year after they were ready to bring the four candidates to campus because somebody protested and said, oh, these people are all of Palestinian origin. It's like, okay, so what do you want the scholar of Edward Said to be speaking about? Cake? I mean, it doesn't make sense, right? And now we see it's a relentless for us at San Francisco State, and I'm very happy to talk about that, as I said. We have been subjected to, in the last 3 years, to a relentless campaign. AMCHA starts and says that I'm misusing university funds. They first accuse us of anti-Semitism. The problem is the university president the next day publishes a statement condemning anti-Semitism, as if affirming the charges against us without investigation. Then they say I misuse university funds and I'm a terrorist. The university conducts not one audit, three audits that have already been done before. This is, again, new audits, and comes up and says all these charges are unfounded. It's not true. They're not happy. They go to the controller of the state of California, and they say to him, no, this is not right about San Francisco State. We want to investigate. The university investigates 5 years of my international travel. 5 years. All political, by the way. Nothing is about receipts, no missing dollars or whatever. It's all about why am I traveling to Palestine? Why am I building a collaborative agreement with Palestinian University, which was actually, I was actually following up on what the president of my university wanted to do. He wanted to have agreements with sites in Arab and Muslim communities. So I said, this is my connection, and I will try with Palestinian University. Actually, I was trying with Bir Zeit first, but Bir Zeit kind of like they were taking a little bit of time, so An-Najah jumped, and we did it first. But I actually had to, like, 7 months prepare and submit and propose it, and it went through all the channels until it was approved. That doesn't work, the maligning. They continued. The stuff that actually has been proven wrong continues to be churning. The mill is churning again and again and again. And the same garbage propaganda is being reproduced on the university website for 3 years. For 3 years, the university says that I'm right, I didn't do anything wrong on the press release, and at the same time, the web page of the university has all this garbage about me. Until a new director of communication comes in and says, this is really bad for fundraising. How are people going to donate money to this university if you are saying that your faculty member is anti-Semitic and a terrorist and so on? Why would people want to donate? You really need to remove that. That's the only time they removed it. Now, it doesn't work anymore. The maligning doesn't work and the smearing. Now we had actually direct attacks. In September, we had an attack on the collaboration with An-Najah. In October, David Horowitz and the Canary Mission put posters all over campus about me, 26 posters all over campus about me, and basically threatened us on campus. Until now, we do not know how did they come about and how did they stay up. The university has not done an investigation. And with that all failed, now we resort to the legal. So we have now the legal, the lawfare project, which is calls itself, I told you, this says that we're going to make the enemy pay. And you can see, I actually like have details in it. I have two articles in Mondo Mais that you can check on that. And one of my students has an article as well last week. It's very interesting also, I have two more points, I'm going to stop then. The timing of it is they always choose the time when they know that we are organizing, do not have the capacity, because we're a grassroots movement. We do not have staff. They start the lawfare project, lawsuit is filed in the middle of June, when schools are out. And our colleagues want to rest and want to write and want to catch up with their lives and so on, go on vacation with their families. They started then because they have staff, they have resources, they have the status quo standing by them. And we have ourselves. It takes us a while, you know, until we actually get around to organizing and so on. They've already had all these articles published in Newsweek and Washington Post and LA Times and everywhere else that actually maligns and reproduces the same sort of maligning and smearing campaign. What it all does, it has a chilling effect that is very reminiscent of McCarthyism. What is the purpose? The goal of it is that exactly to make the enemy pay. So if they are attacking me and they make me targeted this way and they make my life hell, basically, because I continue to have to be in charge of a program. I continue to teach full-time. I continue to advise the students. I continue to advise graduate students, write recommendation letters, raise funds, represent the university, the community. I'm one-person program. We were supposed to be three. But the university canceled two searches and got rid of two faculty lines after the Palestinian students had an event and brought Omar Barghouti to speak on campus in 2009. So since 2010, I'm one-person program. Now we have 22 courses. We have 10 minors, we have amazing students and so on, but you need, how are we going to stop it? by basically wearing us down, by targeting us again and again and again and again, to the point of actually threatening our own security by putting these posters on campus and so on, in order to tell other people in the academy that if you get involved, this is what's going to happen to you. This is a senior faculty member who is tenured. Look what we are doing to her. If you dare do anything, this is what we're going to do to you. This is exactly how McCarthyism worked. This is exactly how McCarthyism worked. Even if you believed in the people, they said red, they cried red, and then people didn't get jobs, they didn't have careers, they were isolated from their friends and so on. And it was basically a repressive tactic. And this is the same thing that they are trying to do today. What do we do? What do we do instead? A, first we're doing, I think, everything right. We are part of a broad grassroots movement that does not say that Palestine is exceptional. It says Palestine. People in Palestine are occupied. It's not the first occupation. It's not the last occupation. It's not the longest occupation. It's an occupation. No exceptionality to Palestine, no exceptionality to Israel or the U.S. No oppression Olympics. We do not say, oh, we're more oppressed than other people, we have more people killed than us, and so on. Every human soul is important human soul, every single one. And we say we are all part of a movement with everybody, and we fight for justice in Palestine with the same strength that we fight for justice in elsewhere. Whether we're talking about kids being killed by the police, whether we're talking about South Africa, whether we're talking about the students in Mexico who disappeared, whether we're talking about the Philippines, whether we're talking about the colonization of Puerto Rico, wherever it is, or whether we're talking about clean water in Flint, environment, access to libraries and education, healthcare, all of them are important. Some of us are expert in some area, so we do that. Other of us are expert in another area. We're part of this movement for justice. And with this, with the indivisibility of justice as part of our advocacy, with the indivisibility of justice as part of our academic pedagogy, our teaching, our scholarship, our commitment, connections with each other, our transparency and accountability to our communities, and we say communities, we talk about communities for justice. We're not just talking about Arabs and Muslims.
lodges. I ride in this wind. On my good horse I caught you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune.
Propagandists are uniting the national symbols of Western countries with Israel. And the purpose of this is all too obvious. It's to galvanize Western public opinion to support Israel's war against Islam, against its Arab neighbors, and indeed against the entire region. When you see three terror events, one after the other, two in France, one in Denmark, with an attack on national symbols followed immediately by an attack on Jewish symbols, I mean, how stupid can you be to not connect the dots?
You're listening to episode 721 of Unwelcome Guests. Analyzing the mind-numbing Orwellian contradictions. Israel, anti-Semitism, free speech, and false flag terror. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Kevin Barrett, leading Muslim critic of the War on Terror, who, starting with the Charlie Hebdo attack, looks at the response of the commercially controlled media and suggests that it may be fitting a pattern, one that can yield more insight into the perpetrators and the purposes of these false flag terror events. If indeed the perpetrators of these events are not, as we are led to believe, bunches of random nuts out there with no larger aim than looking for connections, common threads, joining the dots, as he puts it, would be a waste of time. But I think there's quite a lot of evidence that we see a larger pattern at work here. The question which gets asked a lot in criminal thrillers doesn't tend to get asked so much in analysis of terrorist events is, of course, who benefits. Now, I'm going to start the show with a couple of paragraphs reading from David Porter Price in his Ignorance of Power, Metamorphosis in American Government and Society. He wrote, quote, "Our stance towards terrorism has been shaped by primarily two ideologies, conventional law enforcement and what might be called the Israeli doctrine. As discussed in the chapter on blowback, Israel has the most powerful lobby in Washington. This overt influence, plus the many Jewish Americans either directly involved in government or in a position to heavily influence government policy, has led the US government to essentially adopt the Israeli position. The majority Israeli position is, Arabs are fundamentally violent and have respect only for military force. Any compassion will be perceived as weakness. It should seem obvious that the Israeli strategy has failed due to the decades of unabated terrorism Israeli citizens have suffered." Unquote. Now, recalling Naomi Klein's ideas about the shock doctrine, immediately after a terrorist attack is when people are most impressionable, when it's easiest to slip ideas past them, make an emotional impact on them, bypass the logic. So in the light of that, let's hear the following clip provided by MediaRoots.org, who also gave me that earlier reference.
A day and a half after the assault upon the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon, a conversation with Donald Kagan of Yale University and Frederick Kagan, his son, of the United States Military Academy, as they offer their recommendations for U.S. action. Gentlemen, good evening.
Hello. Good evening, Milt.
This is Donald Kagan speaking on September 12, 2001.
We are at our worst, and the Arabs are angriest at us and treat us the worst when they perceive us as being weak, lacking in will, and unable or unwilling to act. As soon as we do act strongly, do you remember what the view of the Arab world was to us right after the Gulf War? We were at the strongest situation we've ever been in.
Are you suggesting that we've got to go to war, or rather we should...
We are at war.
Go ahead, Fred.
We are at war.
Fred Kagan, Brother-in-law of Victoria Nuland, by the way.
We have no option. I would like to see military operations commencing immediately.
So long as we go chasing around the actual perpetrators, our job is going to be next to impossible.
I didn't say that we know exactly who conducted this attack. What I pointed out is that there are a few groups out there that are dedicated to conducting exactly this sort of attack, and I said that we should attack those groups regardless of whether we know exactly which one specifically conducted this. But we hardly need any more evidence to know that it would be a very good idea to take bin Laden out, even if he had nothing to do with this.
He's done enough already, is your point.
Exactly.
Who else is?
And one key place is certainly the Palestinian Authority. These guys are at the center of all sorts of terrorist organizations that we've seen operate before.
Now, I'm interrupting just to clarify. I got this as one file, but it doesn't appear to be the whole interview. I think this is a selection of revealing clips, but not the whole interview, so I don't have any compunction about interrupting it. It reminds me a lot of the doctrine of the Soviet Union being behind all the terror in the Western world. That was theorized by a number of sort of paranoid anti-communists, several of them members of Le Cercle, and aggressively promulgated in the 1979 JCIT, the Jerusalem Conference on International Terror. And, of course, the anti-terror business, so-called, people who have a direct commercial interest in the preponderance of terror attacks, the more concerned people are about it, the more they stand to profit in a narrow financial sense. That is very advanced in the country of Israel. Now, of course, whilst there are plenty of individuals not averse to turning a large profit, the importance of this from the deep state's perspective is more about use as tool to exploit people, change public opinion for their own foreign policy, larger purposes. So let's hear some more of these clips.
And we also know, furthermore, where they're located. We know that they have extensive bases in Palestine and Palestinian area. We have to take the war to these people. I think we should hit them immediately.
How?
Reason to wait. How?
Air power?
No, I would prefer to see ground forces go into Palestine and hunt out Hezbollah. I would like to see Delta Force raids. I would like to see the full panoply of covert operations. But I would also like to see American ground forces deployed into Palestine to restore peace in that area.
Now, wait, I must ask you, Don, do you mean the Palestinian Authority, the PLO?
Arafat.
And Arafat, or do you mean Hamas and Hezbollah?
No, I mean Arafat. We know he sponsors it. We know he supports it. Then our responsibility is to clean it out for him, including him, and placing a regime, or seeing to it that a regime replaces it, which can suppress terrorism.
Well, now, what does that mean, again, in terms of
it means
military action?
Military force, absolutely.
Donald Kagan, I begin to get the sense that you're suggesting if we do this, we need to take strong military action, including land forces, not only against the Taliban in Afghanistan, but I would suppose at the same time against the Arafat regime in the Palestinian Authority.
Absolutely. I'm sure in 3-4 days, everybody is, in spite of what happened in New York and Washington, everybody will go back to where we were before and think, okay, that was a one shot, that's over. But what would have happened if instead of just having a lot of jet fuel on those planes, they had had anthrax bacilli? Have any clue what that would have been? Now, those are the options that are before us. People are capable of doing that. Our question is, how can we stop them from being able to do that? There is no way.
An unsettling note on which to end that interview, not by any means an unrealistic note. People could, of course, deliver anthrax, and that is exactly what they did just after the 9/11 attacks, but not before the White House had decided they would take Cipro, an antibiotic known to be effective against anthrax. So, anthrax, weaponized anthrax spores were delivered by post, along with these rather childish handwritten notes mentioning 9/11. The date was written there explicitly in case there was any doubt this was supposed to be a linked attack, and containing the phrase, "Death to America, death to Israel." So, a clear linking of the attacks upon the American national symbols, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a threat to Israel. So that is interesting
In the light of the next piece, which we're going to hear, this is Kevin Barrett speaking on Bonnie Faulkner's excellent and recommended Guns and Butter, and she it is who speaks next, introducing Kevin Barrett.
Kevin Barrett has taught Arabic, Islamic studies, folklore, African literature, French, humanities, and other subjects at several American colleges and universities, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison and San Francisco State University. He holds a PhD in African languages, Arabic, with an Islamic studies focus from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is one of the world's best-known Muslim critics of the War on Terror. He is the editor of two interfaith anthologies, 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, and We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. He is the author of Truth Jihad and Questioning the War on Terror. Kevin Barrett has appeared many times on Fox, CNN, PBS, and other broadcast outlets, and is a frequent guest on international broadcast media, including Press TV, Russia Today, and Al Attiya, and has lectured extensively in Morocco, Turkey, and Iran, as well as the U.S. and Europe. Dr. Kevin Barrett, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Bonnie.
Kevin, you have edited and contributed to a new anthology, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. After the shooting and killing of cartoonists at the French magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris on January 7, 2015, there immediately followed a meme voiced around the world, Je suis Charlie, or the English version, We Are Charlie Hebdo. What was this lame slogan supposed to mean?
Well, it was a way of sort of forcing mass identification with the slain cartoonists and editors at the magazine Charlie Hebdo. And I think it was a typical divide and conquer psychological operation because it essentially divided non-Muslims from Muslims. No Muslim could ever say, Je suis Charlie, because the Charlie Hebdo publication had been specializing in over-the-top, extreme, blasphemous, pornographic Islamophobia for years. So by corralling everybody else into saying, I am Charlie Hebdo, we are all Charlie Hebdo, we stand in solidarity with Charlie Hebdo, while all the Muslims are kind of off on the side, like going, oh, man. You know, it basically divided us, and it continued this program that's been in place since at least 9/11. Actually, it was prepared before that. But this is about creating a new enemy to replace the lost communist enemy of the Cold War. And that enemy, of course, is Islam and Muslims. This is very convenient for various special interests, military-industrial complex, the hardline Zionists. And, of course, those are the people who were behind it.
Now, one of the things I found ironic about this Je suis Charlie is that it was supposed to be a celebration of free speech. But then right after this event, didn't the French government start arresting people for free speech?
That's right. It was one of those kind of mind-numbing Orwellian contradictions, a lot like what happened after 9/11, when we were told that the reason they attacked us was they hate our freedoms. So let's destroy freedom. Let's shred the Bill of Rights, pass the Patriot Act, and lock down the country. Made no sense whatsoever that that would be the way to react to an attack on freedom. But that's what happened. And by embodying a contradiction like that in the society, it essentially stops people from thinking. You know, as George Orwell said, that if you can say 2 + 2 = 4, then everything else goes along with that. But if Big Brother can convince you that 2 + 2 = 3, you're in serious trouble because you can't use logic and evidence to think your way out of that box. And so they did the same kind of thing again with Charlie Hebdo. They made everybody march. They got 5 million people in the streets of France marching in solidarity with Charlie Hebdo and in solidarity with absolute free speech, which is, of course, what Charlie Hebdo was supposed to represent. But then immediately afterward, they started arresting people for saying things that the French government didn't approve of. Over 100 people total, I believe, were arrested over the months following the Charlie Hebdo event. And I think there were over 50 or so very quickly, like within a couple of weeks. And one of them was Dieudonné, who is France's most famous, some would say most notorious comedian. He used to be socially acceptable until he started telling hard truths about Zionism, the war on the Middle East and things like that. And suddenly he was blackballed and he's been persecuted by the French government ever since. So right after the Charlie Hebdo shooting, he tweeted a very dark joke. And that joke apparently was not very funny to the French government because they went and arrested him for it and then shut down his upcoming tour. And they also arrested dozens of other people, including high school kids who did cartoon parodies of Charlie Hebdo and things like that. So this celebration of free speech in France was accompanied by the biggest crackdown on political free speech in the history of modern France.
Yes, I've noticed, and you mentioned 9/11 as well, is that what the authorities accuse other people of doing is exactly what they're doing. It's like a projection.
That's right. That's right. And we see this especially with, you know, powerful entities that want to bully less powerful entities. They typically accuse their victims of wanting to do or doing what they, in fact, are doing. The bully always accuses the victim of being the aggressor. And we see this even in schoolyards, where the schoolyard bully will take a little kid and take their hand and, like, you know, make the kid slap the bully on the face or something and say, "Why did you hit me?" Or else they'll maybe just say, "Why did you hit me?" just out of the blue. And the kid will say, "I didn't hit you," you know, and then the bully will beat up the kid. And that's exactly what the U.S. has been doing for well over a century, claiming that it was the merciless heathen, you know, Indian savages who were the real aggressors, and that was an excuse to exterminate them. And, you know, every big war we fought has been pretty much along those lines. The U.S. has always been the more powerful entity. It's always accused the people it's fighting of being the aggressors when they never are. Because why would they? The victim, the weak party, never is the aggressor. It's always the bully, the strong party, who's the aggressor. But they always have to make up an excuse for their aggression. And we see this in spades over in occupied Palestine, where the Zionist entity, otherwise known as Israel, claims the Palestinians are trying to push them into the sea, when in fact this is a genocide in which the Zionists are pushing the Palestinians into the sea. So it's typical. It's unfortunately kind of in human nature, apparently, to behave this way. If we become conscious of it, maybe we can moderate it a little bit, or even someday, God willing, put an end to it.
Kevin, as a quick aside, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but it's been playing on my mind. I saw a tweet after the millions of people marching around Paris. I saw someone tweeted a picture of the leaders of the Western world, of course, leading the march. But this camera view was taken higher up, and it showed a huge blank space behind them. Now, do you think this was photoshopped, or did they do a photo op when there really were not millions of people behind them? Do you happen to know?
Oh, yeah, sure. That was a photo op. What they did was the leaders went to supposedly lead the mass march of millions in the streets of Paris. But they're not going to expose all those world leaders to a big crowd. They're not going to let them march right in front of an actual crowd of ordinary people. So what they did was they took the leaders off on a side street that was really blocked off with massive security. Nobody could get anywhere near them. And they filmed the leaders marching down that street with nobody behind them. And then they took that film and they spliced it, or you know, the video equivalent of photoshopped it into the footage of the actual march to make it appear as though the world leaders were leading the march, when in fact they were not. And this is just one of the numerous, almost countless examples of Orwellian deception that characterize today's mainstream media.
Oh, thank you for explaining that, Kevin, because I always wondered about that. I only saw that once, and I never read anything about that at all. So that was a real picture.
Well, yeah, they took a real picture of the leaders, and they took a real picture of the march, and they spliced them together to make it look like the leaders were leading the march when they weren't. And, of course, this is discussed in the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo.
What is some of the incontrovertible evidence that the shooting attack on the French magazine Charlie Hebdo was a false flag operation?
Well, the question, of course, is where to start. Sometimes when I discuss these things, I start with context, which gives you circumstantial evidence. But let's just start right with the kind of the hard evidence. One strong piece of evidence that really woke me up. And, you know, I was taken in by this for at least a few seconds. It seemed plausible to me that there could be a couple of hothead Muslims that would go shoot at the Charlie Hebdo offices. So my initial reaction when I heard there'd been a shooting there was, I assume this one might not be a false flag. Probably, you know, I didn't think it was. But then early on, we started hearing various bits of news that changed my mind pretty quickly. And one of them was that the interior minister of France, Bernard Cazeneuve, claimed that the reason they were able to catch the shooters was because they had left an ID card in an abandoned getaway car. And this struck me as both preposterous and all too typical of false flag operations, in which the patsies, that is the people who were to be blamed for a very carefully orchestrated professional attack, are set up to take the blame, often by these kinds of really blatantly obvious means, these none too subtle means of dropping an ID card somewhere. You know, they tried that with the Kennedy assassination. They claimed initially that they knew they were after Oswald because he had dropped his ID card at the site of the shooting of Officer J.D. Tippit in Dallas. And then the media reacted with such skepticism that the Dallas Police Department took it back and then said, no, actually, we didn't find an ID card for Oswald. And likewise, on 9/11, we had alleged discoveries of passports at the World Trade Center, where supposedly nothing was left of the plane. Not one identifiable part of either of the two planes that supposedly hit the Trade Center was ever recovered. And even the black boxes, they tell us, were never recovered, which is utterly impossible. But they did supposedly find a hijacker's passport, the passport of Soukami, who was supposedly one of the hijackers. And they also told us that they found a hijacker's passport in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, on the perimeter of the 10 by 15 foot hole in the ground with no plane wreckage, no sign of any plane crash, where they tell us that Flight 93 melted magically into the soft ground and just completely disappeared, leaving no trace. That's the official story of what happened in 93. So we see these ridiculous situations where obviously evidence has been planted to implicate patsies in these kinds of operations. So when Cazeneuve said that their only mistake was that they dropped their ID card in an abandoned getaway car, my eyeballs just started involuntarily rolling. All of the witnesses said these look like highly trained paramilitary guys. Such people are highly unlikely to somehow, I think my ID card slipped out of my pocket as I left the getaway car. So absurd. So that one was a big one for me. And then also the videotape of the alleged shooting of a police officer on the streets of Paris right outside the Charlie Hebdo offices, supposedly taken by happenstance by a bystander, although I would be a little bit skeptical of that. In any case, that video, which was posted to the internet and made the mainstream media, is purported to show the two terrorists dressed in black and wearing ski masks shooting the police officer who's lying on the sidewalk. They supposedly shoot him in the head at point-blank range with an AK-47 assault rifle, which has a lot of power and a very large slug. And yet the head suffers no apparent damage, no reaction to being shot, no blood, nothing like that. And we see a little dust bunny that's kicked up about 1 meter away from the head of the police officer, showing that the only rational interpretation of this footage is that we had two guys dressed up as terrorists shooting blanks. And they pretended to shoot the officer, but very conscientiously made sure that they didn't shoot him in the head with a blank, which is a paper or cotton wad. That would hurt quite a lot. It wouldn't be very pleasant. So kindly, they aimed about a meter away from his head, shot up a dust bunny from the sidewalk, and continued on their merry way. And that video, although it may not be absolutely 100% conclusive, just as the claim that these guys, the terrorists, were caught due to dropping their ID card, that's not 100% proof that this is a false flag. You put those two together, along with a long, long, long list of other items, and the preponderance of evidence, or the cumulative case, as David Ray Griffin put it in the New Pearl Harbor about 9/11, is utterly overwhelming. So I'm convinced and would stake my life and anybody else's life that was dear to me on the fact that this was a false flag of some kind.
With regard to this police officer, did he really die?
That's a good question. The official story is yes. And as I I've not been able to uncover any evidence of deception there. So one hypothesis that was offered by a colleague at Veterans Today was that the officer was shot shortly after the footage was taken. I don't know. That strikes me as a, you know, but when these people orchestrate false flags, these folks have discovered that one way to make sure that the truth doesn't come out in such a way that anybody ever gets prosecuted is to stage it in such a way that if you discover the truth about it, nobody will believe you because it's too bizarre. So they have a sort of a Byzantine or an overly complex sort of Baroque approach to these false flags. Like with the JFK assassination, they sent every major league bad guy in the known universe to Dallas. You know, all, it was like a, you know, it was like a Soldier of Fortune convention there in Dallas, and they were all standing along the triple underpass. So Chauncey Holt, the notorious CIA forger of documents, has talked about this. And likewise with 9/11, a very elaborate ruse was created on 9/11, so elaborate that people who are not aware of these things think you're crazy if you even talk about it. So I think something similar may have happened at Charlie Hebdo. Precisely how it was done, I don't claim to know. But I would say that the fact that we have on videotape a fake shooting of a police officer supposedly happening immediately after the cartoonists were shot in the Charlie Hebdo building does raise questions about what actually happened in the Charlie Hebdo building and raises questions about this alleged shooting of a police officer, whether he really was killed. There are a number of other cases where evidence has surfaced showing that people supposedly killed in these operations are not killed. One very strong documentary piece of evidence showing that top authorities plan such things is at the Operation Northwoods documents, in which they were planning to load 200 CIA agents using false identities onto a supposed charter plane to fly to the Caribbean. And these CIA agents were then going to – their plane was going to cross paths with an unmanned drone. The drone would continue towards Cuba and be blown up, and it would be blamed on the Cubans. The plane full of CIA agents using false identities, pretending to be college students on vacation, would land at a military base, and the 200 CIA agents would get off. And the newspapers the next day would report that the evil Fidel Castro and his Cubans had shot down an American charter plane and killed 200 college students. The 200 names of these non-existent college students would be published in the newspapers, and hundreds of alleged grieving relatives, all of them probably manufactured false identities as well, would be quoted in the mainstream media lamenting the loss of their loved ones. So we know that in 1962, every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by General Lemnitzer, signed off on this plan to have hundreds and hundreds of fake people involved in a mass casualty fake terror operation in which 200 non-existent people would be killed and mourned in all of the mainstream newspapers, with relatives, non-existent relatives and friends mourning them as well. Given that that proof of that event in 1962, we do have the document signed by McNamara. We know that's real. Nobody argues that it's not. Given that, it seems reasonable to assume that in mass casualty false flag terror cases today, there may very well be many, many, many cases of people supposedly being killed who actually are not killed.
What can you tell us about the accused suspects, Sharif and Saeed Kouachi? Hadn't they been tracked by French and U.S. intelligence for quite some time?
Yes, the Kouachi brothers they were on the radar of all of the world's major intelligence services, not just French intelligence, American intelligence, presumably Israeli intelligence, and we know British intelligence because the British mainstream media published that. So they were like the best known terror patsies in the world. They were probably, you know, every time they probably couldn't go to the bathroom without having a, you know, microphone reporting what was going on. These guys were, they had actually been arrested for child pornography a few years back. Now, whether that was a real arrest, which was then made to go away when they agreed to serve as informants and essentially, you know, manipulated patsies of the intelligence services, or whether that was actually just a setup, perhaps to control them, we don't really know. But given that background, given that they were, you know, the best known terror suspects in the world practically, and they were supposedly making impossible trips. They supposedly went to Israel and then I think through Jordan to Syria to Yemen. They couldn't have done that. You can't go to Israel and then get into Syria. They won't take you. None of these Arab countries will let you in if you have an Israeli stamp in your passport. So if they were working with the Israelis then would purposely not stamp their passport. Something funny was going on with their passports. They were obviously intelligence agency manipulated patsies on the radar screens of all the major intelligence services. And in the end, they were set up. It's conceivable they might have been trained to actually carry out a real shooting, but that seems unlikely. They don't seem to be remotely the kind of people who would have been that professional. So they were almost certainly just set up to be the patsies to take the blame for a shooting, assuming there was a real shooting that was carried out by professionals.
Who was the suicided French police detective, and what was he looking into?
That's right. That's one of the most amazing aspects of this case. Another huge red flag. Well, the suicided French detective Éric Fadou, who turned up dead with a bullet in the head in the wee hours of the morning, the night after the Charlie Hebdo initial shooting, was looking into the family connections of Charb, the editor of Charlie Hebdo, and his alleged girlfriend, Jeanette Bougrab. Now, Jeanette Bougrab is a very major suspect in the Charlie Hebdo affair. She turned up immediately after the Charlie Hebdo shooting, and she claimed that she was Charb's girlfriend, and she mourned him in a histrionic way. She looked like she was trying too hard. And at the same time, Charb's family members and close personal friends all unanimously said that no, there was no such relationship. You know, she claimed she was his significant other, that they were basically a family. But everybody else, except for, I think, Sharp's parents, who didn't know her but just kind of accepted her story initially, everybody else who knew Sharp said they had never heard of this person. There was no such relationship. So Éric Fadou, the officer who was shot in the head for looking into this, had found something very stunning and incriminating, apparently, about the fake relationship between the slain Charlie Hebdo editor, Charb, and his phony significant other, Jeanette Bougrab. Now, Bougrab is a professional, big-time Islamophobe who works with the right-wing, ultra-extreme, Likudnik, pro-Israel group in France that's associated with former President Sarkozy. She was actually an official in Sarkozy's administration. She continues to work as part of that network, which makes her a de facto Israeli Mossad asset. And the speculation would be that the failing magazine, Charlie Hebdo, which was not selling very many copies, even after it turned to extreme Islamophobia a couple of years ago, they couldn't sell out their print runs. It had been going out of business slowly for many, many years, and it was losing money with every issue. And none of these cartoonists had that much visible means of support. So somebody was funneling money into that magazine to keep it alive. And it appears that Jeanette Bougrab may have been the operative, an intelligence agent, essentially, who created a fake relationship. It's called a legend in the intelligence business. Her legend was that she was supposedly the significant other of Charb, the editor of Charlie Hebdo. And this would have been used as a way they could have a joint bank account to transfer funds, or they could meet to transfer funds. It appears that the Charlie Hebdo magazine was kept alive by some anonymous benefactor. And the most likely hypothesis is that this was all essentially a setup for the big false flag on January 7th. It may be that Éric Fadou, the French officer, discovered some kind of actual evidence that this was the case. And he then was shot at about 1 in the morning in his office. His supervisor actually is apparently a suspect in this. The French investigators who've looked into this have argued that Gil Friedman is his name, was the director of the regional criminal police in Limoges and then became the direct superior of the officer, Éric Fadou. He would have been in the same building. And Friedman allegedly has Zionist Sarkozy connections as well. So the fact that somebody, an officer investigating the case immediately afterwards that night, discovered something so important that he had to stay up all night. He called his family and told them that. And then he's found with a bullet in the head, and nobody in his family believes it's suicide. And the French government won't release the autopsy to his family, even though they're required to. Something stinks about this. And this is another of those very, very strong pieces of evidence that together create a cumulative case that this was a false flag operation.
Well, as well, Kevin, you mentioned Sarkozy. Now, the other accused shooter, the guy that was shot down at the, I guess it was a kosher deli, I believe evidence came out that in the past he had met personally with Sarkozy.
That's right. His name was Koulibaly. He's an African Muslim. And a few years back, he apparently was used as a player in a publicity stunt for Sarkozy. And we have the newspaper report showing him with Sarkozy in the picture. And it's one of those prearranged sort of photo op stories that's used for political purposes to show that Sarkozy is reaching out to this sort of, you know, the French banlieue society, the African and Arab immigrants. Now, the fact that he was used for that suggests that he was part of that network, that he was an asset of the Sarkozy Israel-linked network that is suspected of pulling off the Charlie Hebdo affair.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. Was it the French 9/11? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You begin your chapter, Pre- and Post-9/11 False Flags, How Weapons of Mass Deception Are Interdependent, with a discussion of public myths or stories. How would you define myths in a modern political context? And do you believe these myths need to be true?
Well, certainly not. The word myth in popular parlance often means an untrue story, as in we say, that's just a myth. So it's well known that sacred narratives that have very strong effects on cultures and societies don't have to be true. Whether they're true or not isn't the issue. But what is the issue is that people have to believe that they're true to a certain extent. Or if there's a debate about whether they're true, then they don't function really as a sacred myth anymore. And the person to look at here, I think, who's you know, done the most interesting work on this would be Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. Dr. Zelikow, who teaches at the University of Virginia, I believe, is a self-proclaimed expert on the creation and maintenance of public myths. Now, he describes public myths as stories about huge happenings in current events or recent history that are believed to be true, but that don't necessarily have to be true. And some examples of the kinds of public myths that he gives are, one, the Pearl Harbor event, the alleged Japanese surprise attack at Pearl Harbor that killed 2,000 American sailors. This had such a powerful emotional effect on the American people that it created a kind of a myth of a pernicious Japanese surprise attack. And the meanings of that were that we Americans are no longer invulnerable because of our oceans, that these evil, strange-looking foreigners from a different culture can, you know, penetrate our defenses and wreak havoc, kill thousands of us. We need to take a very proactive role in the world. And so the effect of the Pearl Harbor myth, and it's a myth, it's false in the sense that it wasn't a surprise attack. It was provoked by the American administration's 8-point plan that was drawn up to make sure that the Japanese struck the first blow. And, of course, the U.S. had broken their code, as had the British, and could read everything and knew exactly when that attack was coming and intentionally left those sailors on the mothball battleships to be slaughtered while they brought the aircraft carriers out to sea. Those were militarily necessary. So this the myth is that there was a pernicious Japanese surprise attack. That means that we need to basically go out and proactively rule the world to make sure that nothing like that ever happens again. And this myth was used to create the American empire of post-World War II. And Zelikow knows this. So it was really interesting they picked him to write the 9/11 Commission report, which is essentially another public myth with a sort of a new Pearl Harbor meme or interpretation. That is the whole point of this story that Zelikow wrote about 9/11, which of course probably was written before 9/11. It was probably the script for the events of 9/11, and it was brought out after 9/11 as the 9/11 Commission report. That story is a public myth designed to convince Americans that they are likely to be attacked by terrorists with mass casualties. Terrorist is synonymous with Muslim, pretty much. That's what that book is really meant to do. So the chapter I wrote in We Are Not Charlie Hebdo describes how to create this kind of myth, you need to prepare the ground for it and then to keep the pot boiling afterwards. So the myth of the terror threat, the Islamic terror threat, was primarily created by the massive, overwhelming impact of the events of 9/11, which left roughly half of the American people with clinical PTSD. So that was the centerpiece of the modern myth of Islamic terror. It was prepared by false flags or arranged events such as the African embassy bombings, the USS Cole bombing, and so on before 9/11. Now, not every attack on American interests was a false flag as far as we know, but there is evidence that those were to some extent. And then after 9/11, in order to keep the pot boiling, somewhat smaller false flags had to be arranged in Bali, Madrid, London, Mumbai, and elsewhere. And I think that the Charlie Hebdo events were a sort of a new centerpiece event designed to be sort of a new 9/11, a European 9/11, a French 9/11. And they've introduced a new theme, or at least reinforced the old theme of they hate our freedoms. So the new big theme of the war on Islam is crazy Muslims hate cartoonists. And they are milking this for all it's worth. Pam Geller, the Israeli operative, is creating Draw Muhammad contests and things. They're having all these Draw Muhammad events. One such event in Copenhagen was shot up, supposedly, on Valentine's Day, a month after the Charlie Hebdo shooting. And there have been a whole rash of these kinds of events and threats. Recently in Texas, we had two supposed Islamic gunmen shot down as they were supposedly planning to attack Pam Geller's Draw Muhammad event. So that this Muslims versus cartoons has become the new meme of the so-called war on terror. And the Charlie Hebdo event, which mobilized 5 million people in France to march, was a spectacular centerpiece event. And I predict that they're going to keep using this Muslims versus cartoons meme to keep the war on terror going for several years.
Well, yes, that's right. You mentioned the incident in Copenhagen. And when that happened, I thought, oh, my gosh, it's the same script, because they had a shooting up a cartoon event, and then they had a secondary shooting in front of a synagogue. And I thought, gee, it's the same script as Paris.
That's right. Isn't that amazing? And it's not just Paris, but the precursor to 9/11. And we have a wonderful chapter by Dr. Laurent Guyanot describing this in the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. An earlier event was the Mohamed Merah shootings. This was during Sarkozy's election campaign several years ago. There was a shooting of French military people. It was initially attributed to right-wing extremists, neo-Nazis. Witnesses said they had blue eyes and spider tattoos, which is a marker of right-wing Nazi extremists. And then there was supposedly a second shooting in a Jewish school that killed some teachers and students. And then suddenly the story was put out that both shootings were attributed to a guy named Mohamed Merah. And Merah was just summarily executed. They surrounded his apartment, shot him dead, and then they had a fake all-night vigil where they kept reporting breathlessly all night about how they had this guy holed up in his apartment. In fact, they'd already killed him. that was used to create a television spectacular to galvanize France. So that particular event, Mohamed Merah event, united an attack on French national symbols, in this case the soldiers, followed by an attack on a Jewish target, the Jewish school. And Charlie Hebdo was the same thing. First, there was the attack on the national symbol of free speech, which the French Republic is proud of, which was the attack on Charlie Hebdo. And then there was the attack on the kosher deli, a Jewish target. And then, 1 month later in Copenhagen, exactly the same script. There was an attack on an anti-Islam cartoon event, that is, an attack on free speech, supposedly. And then, that same night, an attack on a synagogue. Clearly, whoever is scripting these things, just like whoever wrote the anthrax letters that followed 9/11, You know, those letters said, death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. So whoever wrote those letters, and the U.S. government has certified that it was one or more American German warfare specialists, not any Muslims. It was obviously an Islamophobic propagandist, an anti-Muslim who wrote those letters. Same thing in France. The same kind of propagandists are uniting the national symbols of Western countries with Israel. And the purpose of this is all too obvious. It's to galvanize Western public opinion to support Israel's war against Islam, against its Arab neighbors, and indeed against the entire region, which, you know, that's, you're not allowed to say this in the mainstream, Bonnie, but the truth is that there is a religious war going on between Zionism, which is, it's a religion. I don't think it has anything to do with Judaism. I see it as a new idolatry, a very strange kind of cult that is no longer Judaism. But unfortunately, a majority of the world's people who identify as Jewish support it. So this Zionist false religion is at war with the religion of Islam and with the people of the Middle East. The vast majority of the people of the Middle East do not accept the Zionist entity as a legitimate state. If you tune into Middle Eastern news broadcasts, they refer to it as the Kaenasioni, the Zionist entity. They don't call it Israel because there's no such thing as Israel. Nobody in the Middle East accepts that there's a legitimate country called Israel. It's a crusader occupation of Zionists. So, and of course, the Zionists have gotten themselves into this situation where they're at war with billions of neighbors, of course, have to resort to very extreme methods to try to keep their experiment going. And that's really the backdrop to this whole war on terror thing, I think, the most significant backdrop. It may be convenient to the military-industrial complex that they have this mythical enemy, but the real strategic significance of the war on terror, which is a disguised war on Islam, is that it's really about the hardline Israelis corralling Western public opinion and Western militaries to destroy Israel's neighbors and to destroy Muslims and Islam on behalf of Zionism. I mean, that's the bottom line of what all of this is really about.
You, a few minutes ago, mentioned Philip Zelikow. You write in articles in We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, you write that in a 1998 article in Foreign Affairs, 9/11 Commission scriptwriter Philip Zelikow wrote about a coming terrorist attack that would destroy the World Trade Center. And he, of course, as you have pointed out, is occupied with the creation and maintenance of public myths.
That's an interesting quote-unquote coincidence, isn't it?
You can say that again.
Yeah, he wrote that article, published it in 1998, along with Ashton Carter, who's currently our Secretary of Defense. So Carter and Zelikow apparently knew that 9/11 was coming in 1998, because that's what this article, it's called, I think, Imagining Catastrophic Terrorism, or Imagining the Catastrophic Event. So they're looking ahead to a catastrophic terror event that would completely change American society and culture. And it would divide time into a before and an after. The before world would be the world where we felt relatively safe and, you know, everything was going along sort of normally. And then the after would be a world of the war on terror, where we were paranoid, where we were worried about terrorists coming after us all the time. And in this article, you know, he looks at all the political, psychological, cultural consequences of this kind of catastrophic terror event, such as, and then what he imagines is, the destruction of the World Trade Center. And, of course, he's using the 1993 bombing as his excuse for being able to imagine it that way. But it's rather amazing that he called it right 3 years ahead of time. And this ties into the way that myths are used in cultures. You know, myths, especially founding myths, do divide time into before and after. And the after is the world of today, the world of our society as we know it. The myth legitimizes our society as it is today. The before is the nebulous world before the great mythic creation event happened. With religious myths, and I'm not saying they're not true, a myth just means a sacred narrative. It could be true. The Christian myth divides the world into BC and AD, or Common Era today. The myth of the creation of Islam, which I believe is historically fairly reliable, divides the world into the Jahiliyyah, or time of ignorance, and then the time of the Islamic calendar, which begins with the immigration to Medina, or the Hijra. That's why it's called the Hijri calendar. In the United States of America, our public myths divide time into a before the United States of America existed, the colonial era, which seems like kind of another world, and the history of the United States and the myths of our founding, our heroic founding fathers rising up in rebellion against the British and so on. These outlandish, outsized stories are a sacred narrative that grounds our cultural experience of the United States of America. And some of the aspects of our myths are pretty bizarre. You know, Washington saying, I cannot tell a lie, I chopped down the cherry tree, and, you know, throwing a silver dollar across the Delaware. Typically, these mythic sacred narratives do get a little exaggerated. They don't typically follow historical reality really closely and tightly. In any case, the myth of the founding of the United States justifies the country that we have today. The myth of the founding of Christianity justifies Christian culture. The myth of the founding of Islam justifies Islamic culture. And the myth of Pearl Harbor justifies American imperialism going out and taking over the world post-World War II. And the myth of the so-called War on Terror, which is really the myth of 9/11, justifies the current destruction of liberty, the destruction of economies with too much military spending and indebtedness to the international banksters. Everything that we're experiencing today, all of the things that have gotten so much worse since 9/11, are justified due to this myth that we're supposedly under assault by Islamic terrorists.
Could you talk about the myth of the lone nut?
Yes, that's another interesting public myth, isn't it? You know, Alan Dulles, the former director of the CIA, once remarked, and I think this was actually after the JFK assassination, I think he remarked immediately that, you know, it's very interesting that in virtually all of these cases of assassinations of prominent political figures, the case always is solved in such a way as to reveal that the killer was a lone nut. Invariably, it turns out to be a lone nut. And that's Alan Dulles chewing on his pipe and giving us some of his wisdom. He, of course, was on the Warren Commission, and he was the CIA's link to the Warren Commission. And he was also a perpetrator of the JFK assassination, for what that's worth. But, yeah, we're told in the United States that all of these assassinations of leading political figures throughout history, and especially U.S. history, are always done by lone nuts. Even when the official story admits that there are conspiracies, such as the shooting of Abraham Lincoln, it's remembered in the mythic American consciousness as being a lone nut, John Wilkes Booth, a disaffected actor who shot Lincoln. And so that is the public myth that governs the way we react to these acts of political violence. And the authorities who are in charge of creating our political mythology for us, they're self-appointed platonic guardians of our culture. You know, Plato said that every culture needs guardians who are kind of above the law, just devote their whole lives to protecting the society against enemies foreign and domestic. Well, that's what these people have appointed themselves to do, and they think they're above the law. So they've used this myth of the lone nut so that they can create an act of violence, or sometimes one maybe just happens, but mostly they create the acts of violence. They assassinate the people that they feel they need to assassinate. They create terrorist incidents when they feel that's useful for manipulating public opinion. And then typically they find an individual to blame for it. And whether it's Lee Harvey Oswald for killing Kennedy, and even with 9/11, they essentially convince the American people by way of the American public mythology that Osama bin Laden was the lone nut behind 9/11. Of course, we all know there were 19 alleged hijackers and so on, but bin Laden became the mythic villain, even though he denied and deplored 9/11. After it happened, he repeatedly gave interviews in Pakistan to newspapers saying that he had nothing to do with it, that this was un-Islamic to kill innocent people, and he said people in the United States with their own agenda did this, not me. He's made that very, very clear repeatedly after 9/11. But perhaps because our media is controlled, or perhaps because we have this myth of the lone nut, find somebody to blame, and, you know, 9/11 happened 3 minutes after the TV broadcast started showing the horrific images of 9/11, the newscaster started chanting, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden. So this inculcated the mythic stereotype of Bin Laden being the sort of lone nut or the villain behind 9/11. So that's what they do. They basically take these very complex, mostly carefully orchestrated and manipulative acts of political violence that they themselves are mainly perpetrating, and then they pick an individual, or in some cases a few individuals, like the Coaci brothers in France, and their friend Coulibaly to hold up as villains for everyone to hate. And they give us, you know, the 5 minutes or 15 minutes of Orwellian hate. You know, George Orwell's 1984, the population was brainwashed by being driven into theaters and forced to engage in this 15 minutes of orchestrated rage and hate against the villain du jour. And so that's the way they manipulate and corral us. The Western publics and world publics are really herds of sheep being corralled by these self-proclaimed sheepdogs. And that is indeed what some of these people call themselves. The special operations people who do a lot of these killings think of themselves as sheepdogs. They have the right to kill because they're protecting their flocks.
I like your concept of maintaining the myth. And in this instance, the myth to be maintained is the myth of 9/11. Well, then, would you consider the main myth of 9/11 to be the claim that the United States was attacked by Muslim terrorists?
Absolutely. That's a very good summary. I should be interviewing you.
Thanks, okay. You write in the book about the interrelatedness of these terrorist events, events that today are practically becoming a daily occurrence. Would you suggest that in order to understand terrorism, we look for patterns?
Oh, of course. Now, those folks who are in charge of trying to protect the public from this dangerous knowledge will tell you that if you're looking for patterns, you're just dot connecting and you are therefore a quote unquote conspiracy theorist. The two leading terms that they use to try to stop us from thinking are conspiracy theorist and anti-Semite. Now, the anti-Semite thing is strange because most of the time, you know, you could be talking about an event that really doesn't obviously have a whole lot of relationship to Israel, much less to Jewish people, but they'll still, you know, call you an anti-Semite. I was being called an anti-Semite when I was talking about 9/11 and never even brought up anything about Israel or Zionism. I was just talking about Bush and Cheney doing 9/11, and a huge campaign came out against me trying to make me out to be an anti-Semite. And I scratched my head over that one. In any case, they go after us as conspiracy theorists, dot connectors, in order to prevent us from making these connections and seeing these patterns. You know, when you see three terror events, one after the other, two in France, one in Denmark, with an attack on national symbols followed immediately by an attack on Jewish symbols. I mean, how stupid can you be to not connect the dots? You know, and likewise with the whole history of, let's say, war trigger events, noticing that every major American war since the Mexican War has been sold to the public by a spectacular, either fake or orchestrated enemy attack. Every single war. And much of this is admitted to even by mainstream historians. So how can you not connect those dots? How can you not see those patterns? I guess if it's more comfortable not to, and the authorities will threaten you and they'll threaten to make you unemployable and to attack you and throw nasty names at you if you do see the patterns. But I guess you have to decide then, you know, whether you want to be a thinking, conscious individual, you know, you want to take the red pill and see the truth, see how things really work, and go ahead and connect those dots, or take the blue pill and retreat into the matrix of illusion that our masters of the universe have created for us.
Well, you mentioned the criticism of being called an anti-Semite. What I've always found very strange about that accusation is that Arabs are Semites. It doesn't
Indeed.
Make any sense.
Indeed. And that's the subject of one of the essays in We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. It's by Ibrahim Soudi, who is an Arab Muslim. And Ibrahim is he's very annoyed that when he tries to talk about the demolition of the World Trade Center, for example, he's a PhD structural engineer, one of the most qualified people in the world to analyze what happened to the Trade Center towers. When he tries to talk about that, he gets called an anti-Semite, and he is a Semite. A Semite is somebody whose native language is a Semitic language. That's all it is. It's not a racial group. You know, race is a very loose fictional concept. There's not really any such thing as race. You can do DNA analysis. That's a lot more complicated. But ethnicity or language is a real category. So the word Semite just means anybody who speaks a Semitic language. And that would be Arabs mainly. Arabic is by far the most widely spoken Semitic language, spoken by more than 200 million people as their first language, and hundreds of millions more as a second language to some extent. I speak Arabic, so I'm a Semite, I guess, or a cousin or second cousin, twice removed of the Semites. But the reason that we've got this bizarre conflation of Judaism and Semitism, which is not true at all in any way, shape, or form, is that the idiot racists running the universities in the 19th century in Europe came up with this weird, you know, racial categorization of humanity. And they imagined that linguistic categories tie into racial categories. So for them, the Jews, who supposedly originally came from Palestine, where Semitic languages are spoken, and spoke supposedly Hebrew, which at that time was just an ancient language, and nobody spoke it, except, you know, scholarly, very few scholarly people, that these people were somehow racially tied into their language category, the Semitic language. So that was the whole basis of European racism against Jews, which was not sensible because the vast majority of European Jews are just as European as any other European. Their origins are absolutely white European. They had no more ancestors from Palestine than any of us did, for the most part. Most, you know, the Ashkenazi Jews are European Jews, not Palestinian Jews, not Middle Eastern Jews. But, of course, they maintained a sacred language that was Semitic, and that's Hebrew, just as so many of us. I'm in the United States. I use Arabic as a sacred language when I read Quran. Does that make me a Semite? I don't know. In any case, the racists said that Jews are Semites and they have long hooked noses, and that ties in with their having been Semitic. Complete nonsense, racist BS. But somehow that stuck. The anti-Jewish prejudices remained connected with this notion that Jews are Semites, which is not true. And we were then given this notion that anti-Jewish prejudice is a very, very bad thing. And let's call it anti-Semitism, even though that makes no sense whatsoever. Let's stick with what the racists erroneously believed in the 19th century. So it's foolish. And Ibrahim Suudi makes this point that he's the one who's the Semite. Benjamin Netanyahu, he's not Semitic in any way, shape, or form. Sure, he speaks Hebrew, and that is historically a Semitic language. So he's as Semitic as Kevin Barrett is, because both of us speak a Semitic language. But both of us are as white as whatever. You know, most of our ancestors came from Europe. We have pale skin and light hair and light eyes. We're, you know, genetically, we're Europeans.
Wasn't Netanyahu born in the United States?
Yeah, he was actually a furniture salesman, I think, in Pennsylvania for a while. And he speaks perfect English, which is one reason he gets away with murder, literally and figuratively. He's a very slick con man. Just a psychopathic liar, one of the most unpleasant individuals ever to hold high office in any country. And yeah, he's certainly not Semitic, but he's certainly going to try to convince you that anybody searching for the truth about anything remotely related to Zionism is quote unquote anti-Semitic.
Now, I think Kevin Barrett makes a good point. We can understand some things about the world in which we live by looking at its language, and particularly these anomalies, these phrases like conspiracy theorist, which don't seem to make sense etymologically. The US government has, after all, put forward a theory of a conspiracy, yet you're not a conspiracy theorist if you promulgate that theory, whereas other ones you are. In the same way, a Holocaust denier, you might think, would be somebody who said, no, there wasn't a Holocaust, it didn't happen. Whereas the term is used for anybody who questions details of the official account. So you might think a Holocaust questioner, Holocaust disputer would make more etymological sense. But no, the term for anybody who disputes details, who questions the account, is a denier. So that's interesting. If that story needs to be protected by these important taboos. Now, I'm not just addressing established usage patterns of words. There are legal ramifications. So free speech is fine and we all want that. But in many countries in Europe, if you question the established wisdom about the Holocaust, then you can go to jail for that. Some people are sitting in prison for years, not because they committed any acts of violence, but because they expressed their opinions. Church of England minister earlier this year, Reverend Stephen Sizer, linked from his Facebook account to a Wikispooks page, 9/11 Israel did it, with the remark, "This raises so many questions." Now, that was deemed unacceptable for a man of the cloth. he was basically told, if you ever do this again, we're going to kick you out of the church. Now, if you want to see the page, by the way, you can go to Google and type Israel did it. Currently that works. If it slips down the ratings, you could type Wiki Spooks Israel did it, WikiSpooks. If that doesn't work, then they're probably de-indexed the whole website. So you're going to have to go there directly, wikispooks.com. It's a simplistic analysis. These events are not organized by nations. They're not even organized by individual intelligence agencies. It's cliques. It's international groups. It's the deep state, I think. So it's a simplistic analysis. But he wasn't saying that he believed it was true. He was just drawing people's attention to that information. So if there's information out there which is of such import, then who is trying to keep it secret? Why are they trying to keep it secret? Are there senior members of the Church of England who feel very strongly about this on a personal basis? Or did perhaps somebody tap somebody on a shoulder and say, I think you'd better come down hard on Mr. Stephen Sizer. He's a loose reverend. If you're at the top of a power hierarchy, you are going to attract the attention of certain people who might want to exercise power through you. Now, what does it tell us about European society? That Church of England hierarchs, together with the backing of the commercially controlled media, as one, were comfortable to tell Stephen Sizer, what you've done is wrong. You're going to lose your job if you even attempt to link Israel to 9/11. Whereas commercially controlled media, other establishment politicians were very happy about promulgating the story without providing evidence, alleging that 9/11 was the work of fanatical extremist Muslims. Our next piece is The Rise of Islamophobia in Europe. At Socialism 2015, Nicole Colson is speaking on the 2nd of July this year.
I want to begin with a quote. Quote, Islamist extremists have declared war on us and they are attacking our people at home and overseas. They are attacking our way of life and what we stand for. And so we have to stand united with those that share our values. Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that this was George W. Bush speaking about the existential threat of Islamic terrorism. But actually, it was British Prime Minister David Cameron speaking just this week on the BBC in the wake of the recent attack on a Tunisian resort in which at least 38 people were killed. Cameron's explanation that terrorists are attacking our way of life and what we stand for is a slightly, but only barely slightly, more eloquent version of George W. Bush's statement that 9/11 occurred because fundamentalist terrorists hate us for our freedom. It's no less reductive, however, and if there's any doubt about what he was really getting at, another quote of Cameron should clarify. Speaking at a security conference in Slovakia on how to tackle radicalization and terrorism, Cameron made it clear that the entire Muslim community is culpable for terrorism. Quote, we've always had angry young men and women buying into supposedly revolutionary causes. I think part of the reason it's so potent is that it has been given this credence. So if you're a troubled boy who is angry at the world or a girl looking for an identity, for something to believe in, and there's something that is quietly condoned online or perhaps even in parts of your local community, then it's less of a leap to go from a British teenager to an Islamic State fighter or an Islamic State wife than it would be for someone who hasn't been exposed to these things. In making these statements, Cameron was regurgitating the dominant narrative about the causes of terrorism that's developed among Western political leaders, pundits, and the media since 9/11. While Cameron and other mainstream political leaders take pains to officially denounce prejudice and hate crimes against Muslims, their rhetoric and policies have promoted, since 9/11 and before, a demonization and institutional policies directed against Europe's Muslims. This has been seized on by the far right, but also tacitly endorsed by some on the left as well. Although the anti-Muslim prejudice and discrimination in Europe did not begin with 9/11, following the 9/11 attacks, the desire to seek a convenient answer to that essential question, why do they hate us, took on a renewed importance for politicians seeking to use the supposed fight against terrorism as cover for an expanded and robust imperial project. The easy answer was supplied by people like Orientalist Bernard Lewis, who earlier in 1990 had posited that there was a kind of fundamental defect in the Muslim mind that could give rise to, quote, an explosive mixture of rage and hatred which impels even the government of an ancient and civilized country, even the spokesman of a great and ethical religion, to espouse kidnapping and assassination and to try to find, in the life of their prophet, approval and indeed precedent for such actions. Or, as Samuel Huntington would argue in 1993, the dominating source of conflict in a post-Cold War world would be cultural, a clash of civilizations, essentially between the rational West and the irrational Muslim world. And this has led to the dominant view of Islam today in the West, which caricatures Islam as a monolithic religion, one that is uniquely oppressive to women, uniquely violent, uniquely illogical. Now, following on, if Islam as a religion is all of these things, then it follows that its adherents are likewise. And this stereotype serves a purpose for those that rule society. Today, in a climate of rapidly expanding diversity in Europe, Muslims in particular are portrayed as wanting to separate themselves off from the rest of society, refusing to assimilate, as though the goal of society should be to be as Borg-like as possible. Government policies further target Muslims for structural discrimination, and significant sections of Muslim minorities across Europe, as a result, face higher levels of unemployment, poverty, and curtailing of political and civil rights, all of which aggravate discrimination. And add to this that Muslim immigrants watch as Western governments bomb, invade, and otherwise target their countries of origin for economic and political repression. These factors in various forms help spur people towards the kinds of radicalization that produce terrorism, but these factors are rarely spoken of as an explanation. As Liz Fiquette writes, a real grappling with the causes of radicalization would, quote, mean adopting economic and political solutions that do not conflate domestic problems with the war on terror. It would be to recognize that the alienation of second and third generation immigrant youth was widespread long before the rise of radical Islamic movements like Al-Qaeda. A rational approach would address the socioeconomic exclusion of working class Muslim communities from mainstream society, grant basic citizenship rights so long withheld in many European states, especially from the youth. A rational approach would speak to young people's grievances over policing by commissioning inquiries into the high number of deaths in police custody of North African people, and as in France, so in Belgium. But because governments appear to have lost all ability to appraise their fears rationally, the fear takes on the form of paranoia in which any sign of cultural difference, wearing the hijab, for example, is interpreted as a sort of aggression, quote, those are the words of French President Chirac, and a symbol of subversive anti-Western sentiment. Now, it's worth noting that Islamophobia has been whipped up at various points in various places in Europe, even well before September 11th. The mid-1990s, for example, saw an escalation of anti-immigrant policies in Europe, particularly by the right, that in various places targeted Muslim communities in particular. In France, for example, the 1990s saw a wave of repression aimed at poor Muslim, largely immigrant communities in the Paris suburbs. But since 9/11, and then again following incidents that include the murders of far right-wing Dutch politician Pim Fortuyn and right-wing Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh in 2002 and 2004, with the July 7th, 2005 London bombings that killed 52 people, with the bomb attack on the offices of the French magazine Charlie Hebdo in 2011, in 2013, with the killing of British soldier Lee Rigby in London, and of course, most recently, with the attacks on the staff of Charlie Hebdo in Paris on January 7th of this year, followed by the attack on a kosher deli 2 days later. In the aftermath, of each of the each of these incidents has been used to escalate state repression targeted at Muslim communities, including increased state surveillance and expansion of government power, and a massive expansion of laws that increase penalties for actual acts of terrorism, but also new laws that target thought crimes and crimes of association. Tensions also have been exacerbated by the aftermath of the economic crash of 2007 and the rise of populist nationalist politicians. Targets become not only immigrants, but native-born who are Muslim, who, again, are posited as being the enemy within. Now, obviously, a complete rundown of even just the most recent examples of discrimination, hate crimes, racist profiling, etc., would be too much to detail for the entire continent. But I do want to go through several different categories of such attacks, which are generally agreed on as some of the defining features of institutional Islamophobia. And I want to discuss examples to give an overview of the kind of climate of institutional repression and discrimination that Muslims now face. First, there are physical or verbal attacks on property, places of worship, and people, especially those who display visible signs of their religious identity, like women who wear the hijab. In terms of actual assaults on people, property, and places of worship, you know, again, these would be far too numerous to go over. It's worth pointing out, however, that in the wake of the January killings at Charlie Hebdo and the deli in Paris, there were dozens of attacks on mosques and individual Muslims throughout France and in other countries as well. By January 14th, France's National Observatory Against Islamophobia had recorded at least 60 separate incidents, which included mosques being targeted with firebombs, gunfire, pig heads, and grenades. In addition, on January 17th, a Moroccan man was stabbed to death and his wife was injured when a neighbor broke into their home shouting, "I am your God, I am your Islam." In Great Britain, the watchdog Telmama reported that between 2001 and 2013, between 40 and 60% of mosques and Islamic centers in the country, some 700, had been targeted with Islamophobic attacks, including racist graffiti and a nail bomb that was left in a mosque in the West Midlands. The person who planted the bomb also stabbed a Muslim pensioner named Mohammed Salim to death as he was returning home from his prayers. In contrast to the murder of the British soldier Lee Rigby, however, very little attention was paid to Salim's murder by politicians or in the press. You know, and unfortunately, I could go on with these examples, but I'll stop. Another feature of Islamophobia has been policies or legislation that indirectly target or disproportionately affect Muslims and unduly restrict their freedom of religion, such as bans on wearing visible religious cultural symbols, laws against facial concealment, and bans on building mosques with minarets. I'll talk specifically about the restrictions on the hijab and the ban on the full face veil in France later on in the context of some of the political debates in France. But just to say that France is by no means alone in its restrictions on religious expression. Belgium also bans the full face veil. There are local bans on the full face veil in cities in Spain and Italy. And in Germany, several states ban teachers from wearing the hijab as well. And generally speaking, such bans are currently in the process of expanding. Beyond the veil, in 2009, in a national referendum promoted by the far right, Swiss voters approved a ban on the construction of minarets, the prayer towers of mosques. The New York Times described, quote, "Campaign posters depicted a Swiss flag sprouting black missile-shaped minarets alongside a woman shrouded in a niqab, the full face veil, that shows only the eyes, starkly illustrated the determination of the right to play on deep-rooted fears that Muslim immigration would lead to an erosion of Swiss values. In Italy, in the northern region of Lombardy, an anti-mosque law has now been passed under which anyone seeking to build a new place of worship for a religion not officially recognized by the state would be subject to an extensive list of special restrictions ranging from the size of associated parking facilities to the outward appearance of the buildings, as well as having to clear a string of new bureaucratic hurdles. Basically, it's the equivalent of like what Republicans are trying to do to abortion clinics in the United States. So not surprisingly, people might guess, Islam is currently the only major religion not recognized by the Italian state. Nor do such restrictions stop at bans on overt religious symbols. Recently in Spain, ruling conservatives facing re-election in the town of Tarragona have proposed a law to limit the number of kebab shops, internet cafes, and dollar stores in the town center, keeping them 500 yards apart to, quote, protect traditional Spanish businesses and prevent what they call ghettos. Joaquim Enric Garola, the town councilor for citizen security in the suburb, said in recent years more Muslims have arrived. Now, for example, let's say a bunch of Muslim kids are milling around after school. It's better if we disperse them because they could form a ghetto. I didn't realize that was how ghettos were formed. What we're doing is in their interest and in ours. And by the way, the unemployment rate in Tarragona is more than 30%. In Britain recently, Muslim students in four primary schools in London were told that they would not be allowed to fast during Ramadan, citing the students' welfare as the motivating factor behind the decision. After an outcry, students were told they could fast, but only if they received special permission first, if their parents came and met with the principal first. Another feature, there is also discrimination in education, employment, housing, etc. Across Europe, Muslims are more likely to be unemployed or underemployed and more likely to be poor than the population at large. They are more likely to live in substandard housing. In a recent article in the International Socialism Journal, Hassan Muhammad Ali noted, "The majority of Europe's Muslims lack or are denied meaningful political and economic influence and power at a national level. They are among the most deprived members of the working class, suffering discrimination, structural unemployment, and the effects of poverty." A 2014 report based on Office for National Statistics data found that Muslims are facing the worst job discrimination of any minority group in Britain and have the lowest chance of being in work or in a managerial role. Researchers found that Muslim men were up to 76% less likely to have a job of any kind compared to white male British Christians of the same age with the same qualifications. And Muslim women were up to 65% less likely to be employed than white Christian counterparts. Likewise, notes Muhammad Ali, nearly half of the entire Muslim population live in the 10 most deprived local authority districts. Some 5% of Muslims are in hostels or temporary shelters for the homeless. Muslims are much more likely to live in social housing than the general population and less likely to own their own home. In France, the heavily immigrant and Muslim banlieues, the poor suburbs of the north, to the north of Paris, likewise suffer under heavy unemployment and substandard housing. In 2005, unemployment in the banlieues was 20%, while the national average was 10%, and in some neighborhoods it was above 40%. According to the BBC, the unemployment rate for university graduates of French origin is 5%, compared to an unemployment rate of 26.5% for university graduates of North African origin. As author Andrew Hussey wrote last year, describing a popular rebellion of young people in one of the banlieues in 2007, quote, "The Gare du Nord at the heart of this district is frontier territory. It is the dividing line between the wretched conditions of the banlieues, the suburbs outside the city, and the relative affluence of central Paris. Paris is both near and distant. It is a few short steps away, but in terms of jobs, housing, making a life, for these young people, it is as inaccessible and far away as America. For all their modernity, these urban spaces are designed almost like vast prison camps. The banlieue is the most literal representation of otherness, the otherness of exclusion, of the repressed, of the fearful and despised, all kept physically and culturally away from the mainstream of French civilization," unquote. Another aspect, one of the most pernicious aspects, is the ethnic and religious profiling and police abuse of Muslims, including various provisions of counterterrorism policing. In fact, police harassment of Muslim populations and other authorities is a common feature across police and other authority harassment of Muslim populations is a common feature across Europe. In recent years in France, security measures have been tightened in the suburbs, effectively militarizing French housing states, and police are rarely held responsible for incidents in which they brutalize people. Just this March, in fact, two French police officers were cleared from a charge of failing to render aid in the deaths of two teenagers who were electrocuted after police chased them into a power plant following a soccer match in 2005. The boys' deaths had sparked several weeks of rebellion, rioting, of course, in media terms, in the banlieues, which were suppressed brutally by then-President Nicolas Sarkozy, who described those riotings as gangrene and rabble. Not only in the banlieues, but elsewhere in France, police routinely carry out what's known as identity controls, which is similar to stop and frisk here in the United States. Unannounced demands to see people's identity papers that largely target non-whites and especially young people, including children as young as 13. Despite Muslims making up somewhere between 7.5% to 9% of the French population, and we don't know for sure because the French government doesn't actually keep statistics, figures suggest that some 70% of France's prison population is Muslim, and that number might actually be higher. The figure is even higher in Parisian prisons. Despite Muslims making up about 4.5% of the British population, according to Muhammad Ali, Muslims are over 13% of the prison population, the majority of whom are Black or South Asian. And regarding counterterrorism measures, as in the U.S., across Europe since 9/11, there's been a wholesale expansion of the powers of police and various security agencies to surveil Muslims, including at places of worship, to arrest, detain, deport, and even in some cases to strip longstanding citizens of their citizenship on the flimsiest of evidence, and in some cases no public evidence is required at all. In France, the nebulously defined charge of association with wrongdoers in relation to a terrorist enterprise has been used to arrest large numbers of people on the basis of minimal evidence, some of which may actually be provided by foreign intelligence services abroad who torture it out of people. And following the Charlie Hebdo attack in January, there was, ironically but all too predictably, a state crackdown on speech, even as the supposed Muslim intolerance for free speech was hammered on in the media. So one 16-year-old high school student was taken into police custody and indicted for defending terrorism after he posted a widely circulated cartoon on Facebook, quote, representing a person holding the magazine Charlie Hebdo being hit by bullets and accompanied by an ironic comment. So was it in poor taste? Certainly. Was it a prosecutable offense? Under French law, yes. And in the week after the Hebdo attack, according to Amnesty International, at least 69 arrests were made on the charge of defending terrorism, including drunk people and children making dumb or ignorant statements. In the UK, expansions of laws like the Prevention of Terrorism Act and the Terrorism Act of 2006 have made it a crime to encourage terrorism by the, quote, glorification of terrorism. According to civil rights lawyer Gareth Pierce, there now lies ahead the, quote, bleak prospect of imprisonment for thousands of young people, all Muslim, who have accessed the internet prompted by an interest shared with millions of their contemporaries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, in the workings of political or radical Islam. The targets of state surveillance, by the way, are often young people in Britain who have committed no legal offense. Since 2008, the UK has operated a program known as Channel, part of the government's Preventing Violent Extremism program, designed to identify those at risk of becoming radicalized and sort of re-educating them under the watchful eye of the state. Author Arun Kanani notes that between 2007 and 2010, 1,120 individuals were identified by the Channel Project as potentially traveling on a radicalization pathway. Of these, 290 were under age 16, and 55 were under 12. Over 90% were Muslim. One of those was 17-year-old student Jamil Scott, a member of the British Socialist Workers Party. It was after he participated in a protest against an Israeli ambassador that the state suddenly deemed him vulnerable to Islamist or far-left radicalization. Other factors supposedly putting him at risk were the fact that he was a teenager, had a Muslim father, though he himself did not identify as Muslim, and that he had joined a left-wing political party. For 2 years, Jamil, his parents, his aunt, and his school were routinely interrogated about his political trajectory and home life, and he was asked questions about who the adults were who were radicalizing him. What were their names? On one occasion, officers telephoned his mother and told her it would be good to move the family to a different neighborhood and that Britain's counterterrorism unit could have the local authority housing department find her a new home. In January, revised guidelines in the PREVENT program, issued as part of the counterterrorism and security bill, mandated that teachers, including nursery school workers and child care workers, quote, have training that gives them the knowledge and confidence to identify children at risk of being drawn into terrorism and challenge extremist ideas which can be used to legitimize terrorism. This led to the incredible headline in The Telegraph, quote, anti-terror plan to spy on toddlers, quote, is heavy-handed. And so the final aspect of Islamophobia that we're going to touch on are the public pronouncements by some journalists and politicians across the whole political spectrum that stigmatize Muslims as a group. And again, examples are too numerous to count, but the right wing, both the far right and the more centrist right, have seized on this climate because it serves a political purpose. As the Open Society Foundation notes, Europe is going through its worst economic recession since the 1930s. Minorities often serve as scapegoats in times of economic and political crisis. Islam and the approximately 20 million Muslims who live in the European Union are depicted by some as inherent threats to the European way of life, even in countries where they have lived for generations. The myth of an ongoing European Islamization or invasion has been nurtured by xenophobic populist parties that are on the rise across Europe. And this includes both traditional far-right parties and new formations that have specifically arisen around this issue. So in France, the most well-known of the traditional far-right party is the National Front, the anti-immigrant and anti-Semitic party of Jean-Marie and Marine Le Pen. Now, the elder Le Pen had been pushed out of the party by his daughter Marine after yet again making comments downplaying the Holocaust and the Vichy government, which Marine apparently decided that, you know, naked anti-Semitism is no longer maybe in the party's best interest. Instead, it's the Islamophobia that the party is now banking on. Typical was Gilles Parmentier, who recently ran for Vincennes Regional Council on the National Front ticket. He said, quote, not every Muslim is a terrorist, thank God, but every terrorist is a Muslim. The party's calls to shutter mosques and deport Muslims have led the party to actually a second place finish in the March elections. In Sweden, the anti-Islamist Sweden Democrats Party has been getting about 15% support in recent public opinion polls. The party entered parliament in 2010, winning votes after they made a campaign video in which an elderly lady is overrun to get state benefits by a horde of burqa-clad women. In Germany, Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the West, or Pegida as it's known by its initials in German, went from organizing demonstrations of several hundred last year to a high of some 25,000 in the city of Dresden. As Mohamed Ali writes, the movement, although initiated by far-right hooligans, quickly attracted a mass of older middle-class protesters, fearful of losing their pensions and savings, yet content to march under the ethnically exclusive slogan, "We are the people." The group has now spawned offshoots, by the way, in several other countries. And according to one poll, 1 in 8 Germans say they would join Pegida's anti-Islam marches if there was a group in their hometown. Now, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has denounced Pegida and said that the group's leaders have prejudice, coldness, even hatred in their hearts. But of course, Merkel wants to have it both ways. Like many slightly less right-wing political leaders throughout Europe, Merkel is happy enough to scapegoat Muslims when she herself is trying to be the political beneficiary of that racism. So in 2010, as polls showed, 30% of Germans felt that the country was being, quote, overrun by foreigners. Merkel made a headline-grabbing speech in which she declared that, quote, the approach to build a multicultural society and to live side by side and to enjoy each other has failed, utterly failed. Of course, when politicians use rhetoric like this, unless there is a real concerted opposition, it moves the entire political discourse to the right, and it becomes very hard to put the genie back in the bottle. In the UK, the United Kingdom Independence Party has also taken a hardline anti-Muslim, anti-immigration, and anti-European position. And like Merkel, Prime Minister David Cameron, as I said earlier, has been parroting a slightly softer version of the anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant line from the likes of the UK Independence Party. So in 2011, Cameron spoke to a security conference in Munich in which he attacked, quote, the doctrine of state multiculturalism, adding that Britain needs, quote, a lot less of the passive tolerance of recent years and much more active muscular liberalism. Now, hopefully everything that I've just laid out to this point will convince people why it is that Islamophobia actually functions as a form of racism. But I do want to say that I actually think it's important for the left to proclaim that, because beyond all the policies marking Muslims out as officially others, there's a debate over whether or not that you can call Islamophobia racism. Now, it's the case that within Europe, the majority of those who practice Islam are also, by the way, marked as racially different from white European populations, most often being of North African or Arab descent, and often having an ethnic background originating in a population that was once colonized by a European power, sharpening the prejudice that they face internally in those countries as a result. So in France, for example, more than 80% of French Muslims are of Algerian, Moroccan, or Tunisian descent, all countries with a history of French colonization. And the history of these colonial occupations, the legacy of the brutal suppression of native populations, and the stripping of these countries' resources inevitably shapes the treatment of Muslim immigrants and Muslim immigrant second and third generation citizens inside Western European nations. As with anti-Semitism, Islamophobic rhetoric suggests that various cultural practices of devout or fundamentalist Muslims are a threat to the imagined national identity, as I said before. And by the way, anti-Semitism does tend to rise at the same time as Islamophobia rises. So Islam is both stereotyped as a religion that is uniquely irrational, violent, insular, oppressive of women, as I said, and cultural practices around things like daily prayers, fasting during Ramadan, the eating of halal meat, or the wearing of the hijab or the niqab are then used to accuse Muslims of isolating and self-segregating from society. All of this results in stereotyping, harassment, discrimination, and it's reproduced in structural and institutional ways, and socialists have a duty to oppose it. As socialist Gilbert Achcar has written, when the French state concerns itself with regulating the way in which young Muslim women dress themselves and exclude from school those who persist in wearing the Islamic scarf, when the latter are taken as targets of a media and political campaign whose scale is out of proportion with the extent of the phenomenon concerned and thus reveals its oppressive character, perceived as Islamophobic or racist, whatever the intentions expressed, when the same state favors the well-known expansion of religious communal education through increasing subsidies to private education, thus aggravating the divisions between the exploited layers of the French population, the duty of Marxists, in light of everything explained above, is to be resolutely opposed. Now take the question of laïcité in France and how that applies in particular to the French ban on the hijab in schools and on the full veil in public. In France, laïcité is the tradition of the separation of church and state that arose out of the French Revolution and the struggle to put a brake on the power of the Catholic Church. And we would support that, certainly. However, that tradition today has been co-opted by the capitalist state, and the law now has become a kind of cudgel, a tool that is used to curtail religious expression, in particular, as a further repressive apparatus against the most marginalized in society. So in December, for example, the mayor of Sarcelles-le-Mans in the northwest of France declared that Muslim students would not get substitute meals for meals with pork anymore under the principle of republican neutrality. Obviously, the most visible aspect of the use of the law to discriminate is in the debate around the ban on the hijab and other, quote, ostentatious religious displays in schools that was passed in 2004, and also the ban on the full-face veil in public that was passed in 2011. Now, on the one hand, you could argue, and many do, including on the left, that veiling is an indication of women's second-class status in Islam, and that is antithetical to the values of the Republic, and therefore these women must be liberated through the passage of these laws. But this presupposes not only that women's oppression with Islam is somehow totally divorced from the oppression that all women face under capitalism, and that religions are unchanging. It also assumes that the French state is somehow acting in Muslim women's best interests. Those same women who are also the subject of institutional discrimination and racism that rains down on them every day as a result of the policies of the French government. And at its most basic level, these bans assume that Muslim women are little more than passive dolls, all quietly wearing the hijab or the niqab, not because of a conscious choice regarding their own religious beliefs, but because they're forced to. Under this theory, Muslim women who choose the veil are simply waiting for the state to come along to remove their hijabs and niqabs, after which they'll be free to be liberated French women, because French women aren't oppressed as well. And for those who may not be happy with this idea, for those who continue to wear the full-face veil, the state has a solution, a compulsory course on French citizenship, though I couldn't actually find an example of a woman yet being forced to go through such a course. Now, these bans, under the guise of secularism, have escalated attacks on Muslim women. As the New York Times reported in May, statistics collected by the National Observatory Against Islamophobia, a watchdog group, show that in the last 2 years, 80% of anti-Muslim acts involving violence and assault were directed at women, most of them veiled. This includes, in some instances, mothers being prevented from attending school trips with their children, being prevented from walking on a beach, and being denied access to jobs. One pregnant mother who was wearing a headscarf in Toulouse had to be hospitalized after being beaten on the street by a young man who called her, quote, a dirty Muslim. Some segments of the left, particularly the center left, have been actually quite appalling, frankly, on this question, including the Socialist Party and SOS Racism, which is the sort of main liberal anti-racist organization in France and has connections to the Socialist Party. In March, Frédéric Calandre, the Socialist Party male of Paris's 20th arrondissement, banned the black Muslim journalist and anti-racist campaigner Rokhaya Diallo from attending a meeting on violence against women. According to Calandre, Diallo could not be allowed to attend because although she herself did not wear a hijab, she has campaigned, quote, for the abolition of laws forbidding ostentatious religious signs from schools and public space. The act of covering women's heads with a veil, indicating that they are by nature impure and temptresses for men. One will agree that Ms. Diallo's feminist commitment does not seem obvious, stated Calandre. In the end, however, the meeting was held anyway, away from the original space, and Diallo did attend. And here was her answer to Calandre. What we have here is a middle-class feminism, conservative and paternalistic, or rather, in this case, maternalistic. Be it on the headscarf or on prostitution, people are talking about things that they have never encountered. When I talk about women wearing headscarves, it's women that I have met. To me, they are women before being women who wear a headscarf. But yesterday's meeting proved something is changing, that there is an unstoppable movement of people who are not willing to listen to what the Socialist Party says about who is a good feminist. The point Diallo makes about the terms of the debate actually shifting and the state, Diallo makes a point as well about the terms of the debate shifting and the state and its junior political partners pushing toward ever more restrictions. And that's an important point. In fact, writing in the International Socialism journals, Jim Wolfries points out that when the formal law of separation of church and state was implemented in France in 1905, the law did mark a rejection of Catholicism and church influence over the state and sought religious neutrality for the state and state actors, but it actually expanded religious freedom of expression for individuals. In fact, an amendment that would have prevented priests from wearing the cassock in public was tabled on the grounds, Wolfrey says, that it was a provocation that infringed on, quote, freedom and human dignity, and that it amounted to a proselytizing garment rendering the priest a prisoner or a slave. The day after separation, declared Aristide Briand, the principal author of the law, the cassock becomes a garment like any other. And the National Assembly actually adopted a different resolution instead, which extended freedom of religious expression in public space. But today, rather than the state viewing religious garments as garments like any other, all garments are now suspected of containing the hidden seed of religious fundamentalism. A case in point. In April, a 15-year-old teenage Muslim girl in northeastern France was sent home from school because she was wearing a long skirt that the principal judged, because of its length, to be, quote, an ostentatious sign of her Muslim faith. And according to the Collective Against Islamophobia, there have been 130 similar incidents since January. Secularism, writes Wolfries, once a means of protecting religious expression, has become a means of subjecting Muslims and Muslim women in particular to unprecedented scrutiny, anointing petty zealotry with the fake sheen of universalism. Across Europe, from both the right and certain sections of the center-left, and even some of those on the far left, there is a particular argument that since Islam is a religion and not a race, and since Islamic terrorism and fanaticism is supposedly on the rise, then it is entirely appropriate to publicly ridicule or for the state to suppress Islam. And there is the accusation that the term Islamophobia itself is used by Muslims, in particular fundamentalist Muslims, as well as sections of the left, to immediately shut down any legitimate criticism of fundamentalist or reactionary political Islam. In the UK, left-wing writer Kenan Malik has argued in an article titled The Islamophobia Myth that there is a fundamental difference between race and religion. You can't choose your skin color, you can choose your beliefs. Now, we'll leave aside what Rachel Dolezal suggests about people sometimes choosing their skin color. But in France, this debate has taken on specific contours on the broad left and the far left. In the wake of the January Hebdo killings, Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared, "I refuse to use this term Islamophobia because those who use this word are trying to invalidate any criticism at all of Islamist ideology. The charge of Islamophobia is used to silence people." The left front has also opposed the use of the term, saying it quashes legitimate criticisms of Islam. A more recent iteration of this argument comes in the form of a recently published book by Stéphane Charbonnier, the deceased editorial director of Charlie Hebdo, who was killed in the January attack. The book is titled, and I'm going to guess that it rolls off the tongue a little bit better in French, quote, "An Open Letter to the Fraudsters of Islamophobia Who Play into Racists' Hands." In it, Sharb argues that there is a kind of paternalism on the left that attempts to shield Muslims from criticism of Islam, and that as a result, it causes a kind of amplification of Muslim religious identity that further reinforces fundamentalism. Why should Islam, he argues, among all the religious identities, be safeguarded from ridicule and satire from the left? He writes, saying Islam is not compatible with humor is as absurd as claiming Islam is not compatible with democracy or secularism. Now, that would be true if indeed that was the only argument that those on the left who condemned Charlie Hebdo for publishing the caricatures of Muhammad were making. But that is largely not the argument. And I want to make it clear, while Charlie Hebdo was a magazine generally of the left that challenged the far right and the National Front in particular, I do think various cartoons were racist and attacked Muslims, not just the idea of Islam as a religion. And I think it's legitimate to have a debate about whether they were satire or racism, and I would say that they were racist. At the same time, I would also defend the principle of free speech and Charlie Hebdo's right to publish them. Likewise, I don't think we need to be timid in our criticisms of the retrograde forces that carried out the January attacks. The cartoons themselves were a provocation, but this attack was carried out by fundamentalist forces who had, as part of their aim, the specific desire to further isolate and increase repressive attacks on France's Muslim population. And they have largely succeeded in that aim. And their desire was to use it as a means of driving more people toward a reactionary version of Islam. I disagree with Sharpe's view about the cartoons because, at least in what I've read from his book, and I haven't read the whole book, I admit, I think in those quotes, he tries to divorce the idea of satirizing Islam from the larger context of the repression and racism that Muslims are currently facing from the French state. And I think socialists have a principal duty to stand against racist oppression, in particular when it dovetails with its attacks from the state. In that sense, I think satire of that kind, no matter what the intentions were, serves to bolster the right wing. However, I also do think there's a problem with the argument put forward by some on the left, and I include Hassan Mohamdali in this. He writes an otherwise excellent article in the International Socialism Journal, and he writes this, though. The political right has found in the Islamic specter a confirmation of some of its old prejudices toward Islam, the Third World, and Arabs. The left is in principle more inclined to accept the emergence of the other, yet it too has made a spectacular mistake. Although it is capable of recognizing Arabs, it loses its bearings and ability to be rational when dealing with Muslims. Its anti-clericalism focuses on the religious content of a phenomenon. Once the left has retreated behind its supercilious, should one say fundamentalist, attachment to the symbols of secularism, it becomes incapable of admitting that the universalism of Republican thought might be challenged in part or in whole, and that someone might one day dare to write a piece of history in a vocabulary that is not its own. Now, there are, to be fair, some on the left like that, among them the French Communist Party, which was uncritical of the way in which the mass outpouring of sentiment and calls for national unity were manipulated by the state to its own ends. Absolutely, we should be against simplistic prescriptives from the left. But I think Mohamdali here makes the mistake in suggesting that the entire French left somehow has failed Muslims following the Hebdo attack out of a blind, religious-like adherence to laïcité. He makes it seem that there is no distinction within the left on these questions. Yet there were responses on the left that were principled, that were clarifying, and which stood wholeheartedly with the oppressed while not avoiding an analysis of the killings and their impact. The main organization of the French Revolutionary Left, the New Anti-Capitalist Party, spoke out clearly against the tide of bigotry that followed the January 7th killings and refused to march 4 days later behind François Hollande and all the other, quote, butchers of the world, as they called Merkel, Netanyahu, etc. Before the January attack, the NPA had criticized racist cartoons in Charlie Hebdo and talked specifically about the way those cartoons played into the hands of the capitalist state, quote, perpetuating the imbecilic clash of civilizations idea. Along with the NPA, there were other forces like the Party of the Indigenous of the Republic and Lutte Ouvrier, another French left party, which refused to attend the national unity demonstration called by the French government on January 11th and explained why it would be used to promote a further tide of reactionary attacks. In a piece we ran in Socialist Worker in January, Julian Salinge of the MPA argued that it was not sufficient for the left to simply say the killers are a product of French political policy, both domestic and foreign, and can be understood without justifying them as a consequence of these policies. So why insist on that it was not sufficient to say only that? He continues, certainly not in order to judge the killers independently from the political, economic, and social context in which they evolved, thus excusing France and its policies. Rather, it's necessary to understand this in order to shine a light on the discourse and the political positions of the killers, who, from their point of view, believe rationally that they are at war with a certain France and that they consider rationally themselves to be engaged in legitimate defense. And this is the other way in which I disagree with Mohamed Ali. I think he does actually edge somewhat toward committing the error that someone like Sharb accuses the left of and that Salinge describes here, namely withholding all criticism of reactionary political Islam out of what is indeed a positive desire, namely to stand in solidarity with the oppressed. And in thinking about this, and I'm just going to start wrapping up, in thinking about this, I think the left can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can criticize the way that Muslims are treated as a result of the way laws are co-opted to state interests designed to single out Muslims. We can have an analysis of Islam as a religion which acknowledges that all religions are shaped by their social context and that Islam is no more inherently reactionary or oppressive than any other major religion. We can stand for the right of freedom of religion and the freedom to religious expression. And we can especially talk about the ways in which the capitalist state uses such actions to further attack and marginalize an oppressed population and to call for unrelenting, principled solidarity with that population. Yet we can also stand for the right to freedom of speech from attacks by the state, even when the form of that speech is something we consider repugnant. We can recognize that reactionary forces carrying out an attack, as happened against Hebdo and Jewish customers in a deli, is both best understood through an analysis that grapples with the overall reality of the historical circumstances, grievances, and oppressions that Muslims in France face today, while also not hiding the fact that we believe that fundamentalist Islam, as practiced by these assailants, is reactionary and a dead end for the left, in part precisely because it also ascribes to the view that there is a clash of civilizations. Within this context, there are also all sorts of political judgments to be made about specifically how and in what context and when to make these arguments, but that doesn't absolve us of the difficult job in making them.
Now, thank you to We Are Many for that. If you'd like more such, you can get them from wearemany.org. We have time for one more clip. This is Juval Aviv. I have not got the context, I'm afraid. There's a rotating Fox 5 logo in the bottom of the video from which I took this soundtrack. I believe it is authentic. Juval Aviv, whose subtitle explains he is a security expert, also a former Mossad operative, has this to say on the subject of truck bombs.
It's easy to put a truck bomb, as we did, as happened in London, and happens in Iraq or Israel on a weekly basis.
It's easy to put a truck bomb, as we did, as happened in London.
So, was that just an innocent slip of the tongue from somebody speaking a foreign language? Well, while we're at it, let's hear Donald Rumsfeld.
Imagine the kind of world we would face if the people who bombed the mess hall in Mosul, or the people who did the bombing in Spain, or the people who attacked the United States in New York, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania and attacked the Pentagon, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania, shot down the plane over Pennsylvania. Catch me
and hang me. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. I'm still looking for speakers. You could lend your voice to Alan Frankovich's film on Gladio. If you'd like to speak on the show, do email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. And a native English accent is not required. All you've got to do is to be a clear speaker of English. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco, and lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, the website tells me we've had over 2,000 visits to last episode. Very encouraging stuff, more than any new episode. So if you've been passing the address on to friends or posting it to forums, then my hearty appreciation. It's great to see these alternative ideas reaching a wider audience.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
This archival recording is part of a tribute to Michael Parenti, the internationally known political scientist, historian, and activist.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Face of Imperialism, Michael Parenti. Dr. Michael Parenti has written about empire history, the media, theology, and socialism in his decades as an activist and teacher. However, one topic has intrigued him more than others. He wrote that imperialism has been the most powerful force in world history over the last five centuries, carving up whole continents, oppressing indigenous peoples, and obliterating entire civilizations. Yet it is seldom accorded any serious attention by our academics, media, and political leaders. End quote. Parenti addressed that omission in his most recent book, The Face of Imperialism. He spoke at a benefit for radio station KZFR in Chico, California. He was introduced by Doug Everett, host of Radio Parallax, followed by general manager Rick Anderson. Here is Doug.
Michael Parenti is a social commentator about whom the New York Times Book Review said, "Mr. Parenti offers a valuable rebuttal to the drumbeat from the right," and I certainly agree with that, and I'm sure you will too after you've heard him. I first heard him give a talk about the military industry at a conference in Washington, D.C., and I turned to the guy next to me and said, "Who is this guy?" And I later learned who he was. He's authored 23 books. He's been an award-winning political scientist, historian, cultural critic, and lecturer. I think it's fair to note that I don't always agree with Michael's take on issues, but I always find his ideas worthy of consideration. And more than once, he's forced me to change my opinions, and I'll wager that some of you may experience that tonight.
Thanks, Doug. Please welcome Michael Parenti.
Thank you. Well, all the funny and clever people tonight, I'm going to be serious. I'm going to be very deadly. What I want to do is remind us that we should not be afraid of words. And I noticed them being used in these Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Chico, where people are using words that are really filthy, prohibitive, verboten words that you are not allowed to use. Words like capitalism, words like imperialism, words like the super rich. This marvelous formula that's been put out, which says it so well, 1% you guys, 99% us. And you've got these Republicans getting up and saying, Look at them doing their class warfare on us. And, of course, they've been doing class warfare on us every day, every minute. Do it. The audacity is amazing, the way they not only expropriate our land and our labor and our money and our wages and our taxes, they also expropriate our words. Do you know back in the early 19th century, the word manufacturer meant the worker? Manus factum, right? I make with my hands. Mano in Italian, meh in French. All French words are eh. So they've expropriated the word, and that word is now taken over by the owners. The owners are called the manufacturers. They don't manufacture anything. They just accumulate. Well, I want to talk to you about empire and imperialism, because there's a lot of mistaken notions about it. What is the U.S. global empire? What is it? Well, if you read Chalmers Johnson, and he's written on empire, and he knows very little about the subject, I have to say. I'm not usually that catty and competitive, I know. But he said, our empire is an empire made up of military bases. And there are, and there's no denying, there's about 700, 800 military bases. In Japan alone, there's something like 40 bases, military bases, U.S. military bases, in Japan alone. It's not just bases, though. It's also a global network of military and security forces, paramilitary forces, and police in countries across the world. All of these guys, potential killers of anybody who gets out of line, all of them financed, equipped, trained, and advised by the U.S. Pentagon, the CIA, and related agencies. In Africa, for instance, there are 50 nations that have extensive military aid from the U.S. 50 nations. Now, there's only 53 nations in Africa. So a lot of these wars that they hype up and trump up to shatter the populations and shatter the communal production that goes on, a lot of these wars are fought between two sides, both of whom have been armed and trained by the United States. But now empires are not just motivated by power for power's sake. Power is an instrument of empire, not the end all. The goal of empire is to expropriate the wealth of the world. The subsidiary goal is to make the world safe for the expropriators, to make sure any rebellious counter-organizing movement leader or nation comes along, that nation will be hit. The goal is to prevent political leaders and movements and nations from charting an alternative and potentially or actually challenging political economic course. The goal may also be to eliminate competitors who may not be all that radical, but who attempt to strike a self-developing path, a self-determining course. This process of expropriation and domination is called imperialism. Imperialism is what empires do. Imperialism is the process whereby the dominant interests in one country expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, the capital, and the markets of another country. The plutocrats do to other countries what they also seek to do to their own. That's always my answer when somebody says, you mean we're going in there and we're forcing those countries to cut back on their human services and we're buying up their lands and we're doing this? Why would they be so interested and dedicated to doing that? Why are you so paranoid? Why do you have a conspiracy theory? Why are you cynical? Why would you think they'd be doing that? And I say, well, they're doing that to us. These plutocrats and these global leaders are doing that very thing. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of Medicare. They want to get rid of all the human services that we do have. They want to give it all over to the private market. They want to cut back wages. They want unemployment. They don't mind recession. Recessions are not bad things for moneyed interests. These are bad times, but not for everyone, not for the 1%. It's a jobless recovery. Their profits are higher than ever. Recessions are always pretty good. Recessions allow the big companies to buy up small companies at garage sale prices. Recessions allow big capital to squeeze out and outperform small capital with even greater ease than usual. Recessions tame and even break labor unions. Recessions even tame labor itself. Forget being in a union, just people working, being able to get a job behind a counter, a job they never imagined that this was the one I was going to have after college, but actually feeling grateful that I got this because it's 1 inch away from starvation. So we have today in America massive hardship and record profits. It's not bad times for everyone. In 1989, I gave a talk in Berkeley, and I said that the goal of the Bush administration, this was the old man, Bush Sr. was in power then, the goal of the Bush administration was the third worldization of America, and that still is the goal. And that happens to be the goal for every nation, the third worldization of everywhere. In the United States, the rollback began really in earnest in 1978. It was the beginning of the third year of Jimmy Carter's administration. And I remember reading a quote from a business council individual. The business council had decided it's time to wage a counteroffensive. And he said, if we don't stop these so-called advancements, we will end up a social democracy. Now, that term leaped off the page to me. Because there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the term social democracy means, and maybe about 200 of them are sitting right in this room, I guess. A social democracy means a country that is capitalist, but it's very heavily restricted capitalist and heavily regulated, and it's got some socialized components to it, like socialized medicine, heavily subsidized housing, and all sorts of social programs. The social wage is a very substantial one, as in Norway, Finland, to some degree in France, and Sweden, and you know what I'm talking about. But the term leaped from my page because it was some guy in the business council. I never knew they talked about social democracies or used the concept. It was showing an ideological class consciousness that the American plutocracy very rarely wishes to reveal. You see, when they say there's class warfare, they're the victims of it. You're committing it against them. But they would never talk about their class warfare. But here he was using the term. And Jimmy Carter did move. When the business council blew the whistle on him, the last 2 years of his administration, he cut back on human services and he increased the military budget. And some of us, after Reagan was elected, looking back, said Reaganism began 2 years before Reagan came in. The trouble with Carter is no matter what he did to try to please the plutocracy, he was still beholden to labor unions. He was still beholden to the black vote, to low-income vote, to the liberal intellectuals and so forth. And so they really wanted a guy who could go all the way and really hit. And so they went with Ronnie Boy, Ronald Reagan, to bring America back to what it had been through most of its history, a mass population of people in straitened and scarce means and circumstances living from hand to mouth, 1929. Their dream is really to get us back to 1900, where there'd be no more environmental protections, no more regulations, no more controls, quality controls on commodities, consumer protections. There'll be no child labor laws. If kids want to work, why shouldn't they exercise their free enterprise and do it? They don't want a population that is well educated, a population that has a keen sense of its own entitlement, a population that is critical and discerning. That isn't what they want. Their goal is to get theirs. And that's it. Don't believe me. Believe the cover of this week's New Yorker magazine. Have you seen it yet? Cartoons have the greatest truths. They speak truths with a few strokes. It's a picture of the New York Stock Exchange, and in front of it are all these money bags, those big mustaches and the striped pants and the top hats, and they're carrying signs, and the sign is saying, this is precisely the way we want things to be. Another one's got a sign saying, change, schmange. And another one is saying, I've got mine and long live the 1% or something. And so there they are. They're not stupid. And that's the same with foreign policy. Foreign policy, it always comes up. Why is U.S. policy so stupid? It's not stupid. It does exactly what it wants. It operates with amazing consistency and with amazing success. It has stopped social democratic and reformist and revolutionary and democratic movements in almost every country throughout the world. In Honduras, in Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Venezuela, in pre-Chavez. And you can go all across Africa and all across Asia. Any country that has tried to reform and better itself has come and gotten the full force and fury of American power. It has a smashing success. And yet we get books like Chama Jones's book and others like that who write and say, U.S. policy, and here's some of the quotes. I've got a bunch of them in my book, The Face of Imperialism. This is U.S. policy is inept, reckless, misguided, overreaching, arrogant, deluded, aggrandizing, and so forth. I think U.S. policy is very rational and consistent. The U.S. empire builders support those dictators or democratically elected governments or tribal governments or ethnic groups that follow the New World Order of free market capitalism.
You are listening to a 2011 speech on the face of imperialism by Michael Parenti. This is a tribute to his work.
The U.S. imperialists oppose those dictators or democratic governments that seek an alternative to free market capitalism, that seek economic self-development, communal development, and the like. Gaddafi's real sins, do you think they really cared that he killed some people? They hyped up the numbers and exaggerated the numbers, but do you think they really suddenly got a compassion? There are dictators killing people all over the world now, and suddenly it was so urgent to stop him. But his real sin is that he wouldn't allow the International Monetary Fund in. He kicked the oil companies out. He took the earnings from the oil, and he built housing, medical care, and educational systems in Libya. And he built those magnificent aquifers. He brought them up from southern Libya into the north so that people could have clean drinking water and good clean water for farming. All of that is going to ruin now. Milosevic, the same. He was democratically elected, but he was called in the media a dictator and the like. And supposedly all the killings in that war in Yugoslavia were perpetrated by the Serbs only. Most of the killings were not perpetrated by the Serbs. I wrote a book on that if you ever want to look at it called To Kill a Nation. Noriega in Panama, Chavez in Venezuela. He has won 5 out of 6 national elections. Aristide, who won 3 elections and has been kicked out of office 3 times. Allende, who won democratic elections. It doesn't matter if they're Democrats or if they're not Democrats. And this has been the thing with all of these guys, with the Noriegas, with the Milosevic, with Gaddafi. You demonize the leader, and this gives you license to bomb their people and destroy their country. The central consideration is a political economic consideration. It's not about power and for power's sake. It's not about overreaching and aggrandizing. It's about whether or not this or that group abides by the IMF, by international finance capitalism, abides by the oil companies and the trade cartels? Or are they pursuing policies for the many rather than the few, communitarian, socialistic, and the like? How do these empire builders get the American people to go along with this? By using fear and convincing them that they are beset by enemies and political demons from abroad, and by demonizing this or that leader without ever giving you any details. How many times has Gaddafi been called mad, mad dictator, this or that? How many times has Mubarak been called mad, mad dictator? Never, never. Mubarak of Egypt, 30 years he's been in office. 30 years he's been coming down on dissidents. And he was always referred to in the U.S. media as President Mubarak. He's even now called ex-President Mubarak. Not a word about him, because he does let the IMF in. He does let American capital in. He does sell his country down the road whenever he can or needs to. And so we are rallied. We are told to rally around. And the American people are very reluctant to get into these wars. The initial polls almost always show they do not want to go off and bomb people in Somalia. They don't want to bomb people in Iran and in Iraq. And they don't want to bomb people in – I mean, how many wars are going on right now that two-gun Obama is fighting right now? At least six, isn't there, where there's some fighting. You remember the war against communism? For decades, it was the war against communism, the ruthless, relentless communists who won't ever stop. Well, the communists just seemed to have unraveled and disappeared. Then it became a war on drugs. And then there was finally, and now, thank God, they were searching. There was a period there in the mid-90s. They were frantically searching for enemies. And it was the war on terrorism. And that's what it became. There are, of course, those of us who argue or ask, are you fighting terrorists today or are you creating them when you go bombing countries and blowing villages to pieces, countries that are not even remotely linked to al-Qaeda? Do you have any evidence that al-Qaeda really is a organized global network with a command center and all that? Is there really any evidence for that? The imperialists cannot tell the American public, we want you to die for the free market. We want you to die to make the world safe for the super rich. No, so what they say is that all these involvements are compiled by humanitarian considerations. We fight only humanitarian wars. And we get all sorts of liberal and even progressive people getting up, as they did with Yugoslavia, as they did with Libya, and forget everything they ever learned and stand shoulder to shoulder with the Pentagon and the CIA and the White House and the media. The very same people who say, don't trust what the media say to you, they listened and they swallowed it. Or we have to fight a war to ward off an aggressor, or defend our national security, or free a country from a tyrant, or fight terrorism. For decades it was said that we need to be everywhere with our guns and missiles, our ships, our helicopters. That was for the Soviet Union. Why do we need this enormous military budget? Because we're facing a Soviet empire. When the Soviet empire evaporated, that military budget did not shrink. That military budget increased. In fact, it's been growing at a faster rate since the early 1990s than before. So it's not the Soviets. It's to get in everywhere and make the world safe for those who own the world. If anything, the U.S. leaders have become more unbridled, more violent. They invaded Panama. They invaded Haiti twice. They invaded Somalia. They destroyed Yugoslavia. They invaded Afghanistan. They invaded and occupied Iraq and destroyed it. They just this last 6 months destroyed Libya with 2,000 sorties. And they were probably going to create another militant Islamic extremist militant base there. The empire sees only two types of states beyond its borders. Either you're a vassal state, a satellite, that is, or sometimes called a client state, and you do what we want. You throw your land labor markets open and say, come on in, boys, it's all yours. Invest whatever way you want and all that. That's the vassal states, and the allies are pretty much qualify as vassals. I mean, they pretty much stay within the NATO perimeter. In fact, they play a major role in some of the operations. And the second kind of state is an enemy state or a potential enemy state. If you're not a vassal to the global imperialists, then you are a potential enemy. If you are committing independent acts, we have to keep an eye on you. And since you're a small state, we don't say Iraq is a danger to us. We say Iraq may emerge as a regional power. And that region is the Middle East. And that was what they were saying. They're now saying that same terminology in regard to Iran, which they're getting ready to hit. Because they learned the formula from Libya and from Yugoslavia, which is you can destroy a country without losing a single soldier. You just hit them from the air. Destroy their utilities, their ports, their power lines, their houses, their hospitals, everything else, their transportation systems and the like. And so the crucial determinant is, where does a nation fit in its economy in relation to the global economy? The empire also feeds off the republic. Where do you think the empire gets its resources to do all this? They get it from us. They get it from their own people, from our taxes. The empire is a very costly affair. Rich global military power. The Pentagon is stronger than ever, but a poor, depleted republic. Indebted states and municipalities. The empire is not in decline. There are a whole bunch of books that have come out about Sorrows of Empire, Twilight of Empire, and the like. The empire is not in decline. It's stronger than ever. The republic is in decline. There's whole-scale resistance. Occupy Wall Street, occupy Chico, occupy Oakland, and the like. Now, ultimately, the empire, like any parasite, may kill its host. It's may devour the republic, and that's, in fact, what I seem to be describing. I mean, we have a republic whose public services are going from bad to worse, whose fiscal viability is going from bad to worse, major breakdowns of state and local governments, budget crises, the same story. Everywhere I go, I look in the local papers, every single state government in debt, can't meet this, cutting back on programs, spending freeze. Well, what do we do about this? Here's what I think we should do. We should move toward socialism. And here's what I mean by socialism. Don't be frightened by it. The sub-theme of this talk was do not be afraid of words. They teach us to be afraid of words like imperialism, capitalism, socialism. You want to know what socialism is? I remember teaching my students at State University, and they say, socialism, how would it be? What would it be? How would it work? I said, well, you're sitting in it right now. You're going to a state university. Nobody's making a profit off this. It is publicly funded, and you're getting an education that's every bit as good as some of the private universities that are just down the road, and even better than most of the private universities. So don't say socialism doesn't work. It's working for you. You're using it. And the French medical system is socialist, and they're all happy with it. And you don't have people ready to die because they can't get medical care. So I say, socialism, use it when it works. I support socialism because it works and when it works. Other times when it doesn't work, maybe you can try communal ownership or private ownership. Cuba is going into private ownership for certain kinds of services and such, because to have the state be the plumber, go to the state to get a plumber, you wait 5 days, and by then you may be drowning. But in healthcare, education, utilities, transportation, environmental care, in banking, we have one state in the union, North Dakota. North Dakota, the only state with maybe two others that is not facing a crisis of insolvency. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the monies that North Dakota collects from the people go into public banks. And they don't go off to private banks that siphon off and make money off it. We had a bill that was passed this legislature. Is that not right? And that Jerry Brown, who pretends to be governor of this state, vetoed it. He said, no, we leave our money in private banks. You really have lost it over the years, Jerry. Okay. The thing is that you shouldn't lose it. And whether you agree with everything I said or not, even my dear beloved friend Doug had to say that, I don't agree with everything he says. Oh, but you learn, you get your eyes opened and you get a little, gives you something to think about. If I did that, thank you very much.
That was the acclaimed author, activist, and teacher, Dr. Michael Parenti, speaking on imperialism. He appeared, along with comedian Will Durst, at a benefit for a California radio station on October 27, 2011. KZFR in Chico is volunteer-run, community-based, and listener-supported. Tune in to 90.1 FM next time you drive on I-5 between Sacramento and Red Bluff. Thanks to Kyle Porter of Paradise Audio for this recording. Michael Parenti grew up in a conservative, Catholic, working-class Italian community in New York City. He's a prolific author and an engaging speaker. He wrote 23 books, among them Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, History as Mystery, and Against Empire. His website is michaelparenti.org. A link is on TUC Radio's website. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's TUC radio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a 1-hour audio CD of Michael Parenti's Face of Imperialism, recorded in Berkeley and Chico, California, by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition, we again visit with Dr. Terry Allen Coopers, a forensic psychiatrist and the author of Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. In our first visit, available online at radiocurious.org, Dr. Coopers describes the abysmal conditions in which an estimated 100,000 incarcerated people, both men and women, are held in solitary confinement in the United States. Kept in dark, cold, and often wet cells, more or less 8 feet by 10 feet in size, many have little or no human contact, sometimes for years on end. Many suffer from mental illness prior to or as a result of living in solitary confinement. This results in significant long-term damage to these people as individuals and our society as a whole. In the second of our two-part series, Dr. Coopers shares stories of prisoners held in solitary confinement and what he believes is necessary to achieve meaningful rehabilitation to people who have committed crimes and have been sentenced to prison. When Dr. Terry Coopers and I visited by phone from his home in Oakland, California, on February 14, 2018, we began this second visit when I asked him to describe what he calls a rehabilitative attitude.
Well, we were developing a strong rehabilitation program in the prisons through the 1970s, and this involved educational pursuits. Most people who go to prison have never finished high school. And there were college classes. Penn was financing college classes in prison. There was vocational training. There were meaningful shops where prisoners learned metalworking, cabinet making, and so forth. And in the 1980s, because of a lot of crowding, prisons became out of control. There was a lot of violence. There were riots that made the newspapers. And there was a campaign by conservative politicians to stop coddling the prisoners. So two things happened. One is that the rehabilitation programs were slashed. The funding was just cut off for them. And the second is that they turned to constant 24-hour lockup, and that's the advent of the supermax prison. This was in the 1980s, and I call this a historic wrong turn. What we need to do is go back and uncrowd the prisons, that is, reduce the prison population, for instance, to stop putting low-level drug offenders in prison. Straight away, we should do that. What they need is some kind of substance abuse treatment out in the community, and they would do much better than going to prison.
At what level is a low-level drug offender?
Well, what I mean is that people who use drugs and they do petty crimes in order to support their habit, they have a drug problem, and it's a problem that needs treatment. If they go to prison and or jail, what the studies show is that their rate of substance abuse stays about the same. That is, they go into prison with a substance abuse problem, they come out of prison with a substance abuse problem. If they go to a treatment program in the community, about 60 to 80% of them will be clean and sober after 3 years. So it makes no sense, for instance, to violate people's parole and send them back to prison because they had a dirty urine. Rather, they should be mandated to take part in a substance abuse treatment program in the community. So that's what I mean by low-level offenders. Of course, if there's a violent crime, it needs to be another strategy, and I have ideas about that, but that's not what I'm talking about with low-level drug offenders.
Well, let's talk about a strategy for violent crime, because that has to do with the behavior of a person put in prison that might get them sent to the supermax.
That's correct. Now, solitary confinement in prison is not supposed to be triggered by one's crime of conviction. That is, supermax is a punishment inside prison. The prison sentence is the punishment for the crime of conviction. And theoretically, and according to all standards, prisoners are sent to solitary confinement because of actions they've taken, or in many states, gang affiliations, inside prison. And it's not a sentence by a court. The violent crime should not be why someone is in supermax. Unfortunately, a lot of states violate this basic principle. But it should be about behaviors inside prison. So people who have committed violent crimes can be in general population in a maximum security prison.
Let's talk about the rehabilitative attitude that you discuss in your book, Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation, and how we can abolish it.
Well, I spoke in the last segment about the culture of punishment, where the entire relationship between officers and prisoners becomes rule violations. There are just lots and lots of rules, much more than in the free world. And if a prisoner violates a rule, it's the officer's job to write them a disciplinary infraction and punish them. And basically, the relationship gets reduced to that. So it's all negative. It's all about punishments, and then brutal takedowns called cell extractions follow. What I'm proposing is that we re-examine the relationship between officers and prisoners. For instance, there was a supermax solitary confinement unit in the state of Washington that had an extraordinary number of cell extractions, but they would have 60 or 80 cell extractions a week. It was only a few hundred cells in the supermax. These are very violent events where five or six officers dressed in riot gear first spray the prisoner with immobilizing gas and then crash into a cell and take him down, which usually means slamming him against a wall and each officer grabs one limb. This is too many, and the central office in the Department of Corrections in Washington said something's going wrong at that prison. They changed the superintendent. They sent a new superintendent there. The new superintendent went around the first day on the job and met all officers individually and said, look, I want you to make me a promise. I want you to call the prisoners by their last name. I want you to call them Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith. And I want you not to use insults and swearing when you interact with them. Would you promise me to do that? And all the officers said, sure. And he said, and I'll bet you the things get better here. Then he went to every single prisoner. Here's the warden, the new superintendent, going to every single prisoner and saying the same thing. I want you to call the officers by their name, do not swear at them, and act respectfully, and I promise you things will improve. And the prisoners said, okay, I agree. I mean, here they were being shown the respect that the warden was coming to see them personally. And in fact, the rate of cell extractions went down to practically zero in that prison. It was almost a magical occurrence, a turnaround. Well, there is an idea about the rehabilitative attitude. People who go to prison are very concerned about respect. They feel they've been disrespected at every turn. For instance, African Americans feel disrespected by the police, who patrol them closely and regularly frisk them on the street and say nasty things to them. There's a lot of racism, and practically 50% of prisoners are African Americans. If instead of being disrespected anew in the prison, the staff talked to the prisoners with respect and also had other things to talk about other than rules and rule violations, then the prisoners would be motivated to behave a lot better. And what they would start to do is be concerned about their future after they get out of prison rather than how they're going to get back at an officer who just cussed them out or did some terrible punishment.
I'd like to discuss that further with you, but let's backtrack for a minute and stay with cell extractions. You describe that what they do, they being the guards, take the prisoner down. What does that mean, and what happens to the prisoner? Is the prisoner taken, extracted from the cell, and where do they go?
Yes, that is what the word means, cell extraction. They take the prisoner out of a cell. The prisoner is in an isolation cell. He or she cannot cause trouble, really, because he or she is locked in a cell by themselves, usually. However, what will happen is an argument will arise over a minimum order that the officers give. For instance, the prisoner on the inside of the cell might be thinking, they are serving me rotten food. I found bugs in the food, or it was cold, or it tasted nasty. I think they're poisoning it. I want to talk to somebody in the cafeteria service about the terrible food, and therefore I'm not going to return my food tray. The officers say, okay, that's enough. We're going to do a cell extraction. They stop talking, and what they do is assemble their extraction team. Then the prisoner, meanwhile, is getting his back to the wall and saying, okay, if that's the way you want to treat me, come on in. Try to take me down. So a takedown is something that happens in a state mental hospital. That is, the staff surrounds someone who's out of control. They each grab a limb and they bring them to the floor, hopefully as peacefully as possible. But in a prison where everything is sort of escalated, the officers dress up. They have padding on their legs, their arms, their chest. They wear a football helmet, and they have a gas mask on. They first spray the prisoner in his cell, spray pepper gas, and then they open the door and rush in. And each officer grabs one arm or leg, and someone is carrying a shield and uses a shield to shove the prisoner against the far wall. That's called a cell extraction. And then they're going to put handcuffs on the prisoner and take him out of the cell.
And then what do they do with him?
Well, there are rules that they have to detoxify him. They have to take him to the nurse. This is the policy in most states, and there are national standards on this. Take him to the nurse, who will examine him to see if there's been damage either from the pepper spray or from the physical abuse. And then once he is cleared by the nurse, they will put him back in a solitary confinement cell, often the same cell, which should have been decontaminated because it's got pepper spray in it. But often they'll throw him back in the same cell, and therefore he'll have pepper spray in his cell. And then they write him a ticket, a disciplinary infraction, and usually he'll be punished with more time in solitary confinement.
So basically, do I hear correctly that there's a prisoner who would like to have something done, he's in isolation, unable to get out, and refuses, in the example that you gave, to return the food tray, and the guards unilaterally, without any consultation, go in and beat up the prisoner, put mace or some other gas in the cell first, take him out, have him checked by a nurse, and bring him back to the same place, all within maybe an hour, 2 hours?
That is absolutely correct. And then he is assigned more time, punished with more time in solitary. That brings up a subject about the rehabilitative attitude. If instead of doing a cell extraction immediately, there was a procedure where the warden, for instance, or the shift commander would come and talk to the recalcitrant prisoner and just show up and say, what's going on here? My officers tell me that they're going to have to do a cell extraction. Is that what you want? Usually, I would say in a large majority of cases, the prisoner, having been shown the respect that the warden, the chief person, is coming to talk to them, will tell the warden, look, the food is rotten. And the warden will say, I will look into that. Would you please do what the officers are asking? Almost all cases, the prisoner will then do it because he's been shown some respect.
Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Dr. Terry Allen Coopers, a forensic psychiatrist based in Oakland, California. He's the author of Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Terry, would you share with us the story of a disruptive prisoner and how that began to morph the policy of solitary confinement?
This is one of the main points of my book. I've been all around the country doing class action lawsuits in various states. And in my investigations to testify in the lawsuits, I've toured the facilities and I've seen the best programs that are most effective. For instance, the Supermax unit I described in Washington, I visited there, and I saw that a prisoner in that setting knows that if they have a really valid complaint about what's going on, the superintendent will come and visit them and they can talk about it. That prisoner is not likely to make trouble. So what needs to happen as an alternative is that punishments need to be something other than isolation. For instance, you can take away privileges or you can take away points or various lesser punishments. And when prisoners are dangerous when mixed with each other, for instance, prisoners of rival gangs, they need to be separated. But in each place of separation, there need to be all of the programs they would ordinarily have. One of the main things that needs to happen is intensive mental health treatment. Selectively, people with serious mental illness go to solitary confinement, and then in solitary confinement, they're usually the most likely to be the subject of a cell extraction. So there needs to be a setting within the correctional system where people who have mental illness can be treated intensively, and meanwhile, the security is very high. These are typically called residential treatment facilities inside the prison or intermediate care units. We did that in Mississippi as the outcome of a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, and a large portion of the prisoners in the Supermax, Unit 32 at the Mississippi State Penitentiary, were suffering from serious mental illness. And what was established was an intermediate treatment program where they would receive the intensity of treatment that their condition required.
There was an incident that you review in your book that talked about a therapist meeting on a regular basis with a very angry man. Can you share that story with us?
The event occurred in a prison in New Zealand, and the therapist was visiting the United States doing trainings, which I went to. And I spoke with her about it. It was a training about therapy in general. But I told her I do work in prison, and she told me, well, she works in prison too. This woman was a Pacific Islander, and the prisoner in question was a Pacific Islander. And this occurred in a New Zealand prison. The prisoner was on the back unit of a solitary confinement cell block. That is, the prisoners in the cell block, when they misbehave, they're put further back in sort of a darker and more isolated place. And staff had stopped visiting this man except for to deliver food because he was so angry and he would constantly scream at them and call them names. She said, I want to talk to that man. And the officer said, well, it's at your own risk. He throws things out of the cell and, you know, he's just a terrible person. She said, that's okay. I want to go talk to him. This is a large woman and very mother-like. She's just very warm and nurturing. She says, now, why do you want to behave like that? And the man stopped being angry, settled down, and talked to her. And he told her that they treat him with disrespect. They're always punishing him. They beat him up a lot. And she said, well, look, you need to get out of here. I think I can help you get out of here. Will you work with me? And he said, yes. She came back to see him each day, and she said, look, the officers are going to need you to be peaceful if they're going to let you out of your cell. Can you do that? He said, yes, if they'll leave me alone. And she said, okay. And she talked to the officers, and she said, I want him to walk up and down the hall between the cells. They said, he can't do that. He's dangerous. He'll throw some kind of a spear through one of the cell doors or something. She said, no, he won't. Give it a try. And they did. So he walked up and down the hall and did not get into any trouble. And she said to the officers, see, you can let him out of his cell. She said, I want him to go to the day room. And they said, well, that would be dangerous. She said, give me a chance here. And she went and talked to him and said, the officers are going to let you go to the day room. You have to behave yourself. Can you do it? And he said, yes. So this process kept going. And then she said, he needs to be in the day room with another prisoner. So she negotiated with the officers to let him be with another prisoner who he would pick, someone he got along with. They went to the day room together and played checkers, and he did fine. And gradually she worked him out of the solitary confinement unit. Now, he's one of the most recalcitrant, angry, and disruptive prisoners I've ever heard of. So if it works with him, something in that kind can work with all of the prisoners in solitary. Generally, when I visit a solitary unit, the people I meet are very ordinary. Perhaps they did a crime when they were in their teens, they did drugs, but they've been sitting in prison. They're very thoughtful. They've been educating themselves. And if given a chance, they would do fine out in the general population or out in the community. So the trick is to find the incremental steps that can get them out of solitary and into a more social functioning setting.
So if we stay with that, how do we get the administrative or the legislative authorities to implement it?
Well, actually, they are implementing it. New York, Maine, Illinois, Colorado, all the legislators in those states have made it illegal to put people with mental illness in solitary confinement. So they have learned, they've been educated that people with mental illness, their condition is exacerbated by isolation. So laws have been passed. Generally, what happens is that intelligent commissioners and administrators and legislators, they understand the damage by explaining how damaging solitary confinement is for human beings. They eventually get the point, and they know that the prisoners they have in solitary are deteriorating. They're becoming more and more disturbed and more disruptive, and so solitary is not working. In Mississippi, we eventually closed the Supermax facility, Unit 32, which, if it's true that we need solitary in order to discipline a rowdy prison population, we would think that the violence would increase in the system. Whereas actually, after we closed solitary, this was the result of a lawsuit, the violence rate in the entire Department of Corrections of Mississippi decreased. So that disproves that we need it to handle violence. Well, a lot of administrators agree with that, and they're trying their best to close their solitary units. Colorado has succeeded. Rick Ramish, the director there, has announced in the New York Times in an op-ed that he has gotten rid of solitary confinement in Colorado. And the way to do it is to build programs that are aimed at the particular capacities and needs of prisoners, and then put them in the program, a prisoner in a program who's functioning and learning something and has some hope of improving him or herself so that he or she can get out and succeed in the community, those prisoners will not get into trouble. And that's the basis for ending solitary.
What do you think of the concept or the possibility of engaging legislators to go to a prison and see a solitary cell and, by obviously certain agreements beforehand, that they be put into a solitary cell and left there for an hour or so to see what the situation is like?
I think it's an excellent idea, and we've done that in many states. Illinois has done that. They closed their Supermax Solitary Confinement Unit, TAMS, in southern Illinois, and they had legislators do that. And then the legislators came back and talked to the legislature and the newspapers, and that's an excellent strategy. Because, you know, it's all about empathy. we tend to villainize prisoners, the whole idea of lock them up and throw away the key. Disproportionately, racial minorities are in prison, so it's black and brown prisoners. To have the public have some kind of empathy, some kind of concern about their fate, would improve a whole lot of the difficulty that we have in the correction system. And having people go in and experience what it's like in solitary, and then to proceed with the thought process, well, wait a minute, if this is terrible to be in solitary, why are we putting so many people in this terrible situation? Don't we have any compassion for them? And that's what will result in prison reform.
Well, Dr. Terry Coopers, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you. Would you share with us a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life and gave you a new introspection into yourself and your world?
Well, I can do that in relation to the prison work that I do. And the epiphany was when I first went into L.A. County Jail and saw what was going on. This was in the early 70s. I had been the doctor for the Black Panthers Free Clinic in South Central Los Angeles, the Bunchy Carter Clinic, where we treated people in the community for free. That was the purpose of the clinic. But we also treated the members of the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles. COINTELPRO, a national police alliance, and the Los Angeles Police Department attacked the Panther office and shot at Panthers, wounding 13 Panthers, and they went to the jail hospital. I then went to the jail hospital to see them because I was their doctor, and the law provided that if you go to jail, you can have your doctor come see you in the jail. So I went in, and I saw them. I saw the horrible treatment they were getting. They were in shackles. Their IVs weren't running. I reported that to the press. And a few years later, the ACLU sued the Los Angeles County over horrible conditions in the jail, and they asked me to be their expert. I went in and looked throughout the whole jail, and what I saw was more people with more serious mental illness than I'd ever seen anywhere, any hospital I'd been in. And the crowding was just horrible. People were inactive. They were sleeping in the day room. It was just a dreadful scene. I reported that in court. But the thing about going in and seeing that, and it's something different than what we hear about generally, it doesn't make the press that things are so horrible inside correctional facilities. Once you see it, you sort of have to do something about it. So for the rest of my career, I've been testifying as an expert and trying to accomplish prison reform.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I have many goals. I'm a musician. I have writing I would like to do, but I will always be doing some kind of prison reform. We have to downsize and eventually get down to minuscule prisons, and therefore we need to provide programs in the community, beginning with education, but certainly public mental health in the community so that people won't end up behind bars. Dostoevsky was absolutely correct that you can gauge a society's worth by going inside its prisons. And the United States fails that test. We have some of the worst prisons and we have the most crowding in the whole world.
And finally, Dr. Terry Coopers, can you recommend a book to our listeners?
Yes, there is a book. My book I wrote myself. It's a single author book. There is a book called Hell is a Very Small Place, edited by Gene Casella, Jim Ridgway, and Sarah Shord, and printed by the New Press. And what it is a collection of essays, some by experts and talking heads like me, but many of them by people who have experienced solitary confinement, ex-prisoners who are now out, or even some are still in, who have been in solitary confinement and write about it very poignantly.
Well, Terry Allen Coopers, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
This has been the second in a two-part series on solitary confinement here in the United States. Part one may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. An estimated 100,000 prison inmates are locked in cold, dark, and often wet cells, more or less 8 feet by 10 feet in size, with little or no human contact. In some cases, this goes on for years on end. Our guest was forensic psychiatrist Dr. Terry Allen Coopers, based in Oakland, California. He's the author of Solitary, the inside story of supermax isolation and how we can abolish it. The book that Terry Coopers recommends is Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement, edited by Jean Casella, James Ridgway, and Sarah Shoard. This program was recorded on February 14, 2018. There are over 700 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're all free to listen, download, share as my gift to you. Your comments, ideas, and suggestions are always appreciated. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal mail address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Jason Greenberg is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.